Welcome, everybody, to the Chips and Tips podcast. I'm Tim Paul from Toolpath, and this week's guest is another Chips and Tips podcast host, Justin Gray. That's Gray with an A. Justin is the co-founder and CTO of Toolpath, visionary behind our AI tools that are helping machinists make parts more awesomely. And I just consider Justin a friend, a maker, problem solver, all around super geek. I'm really excited to have you here, Justin. Can you give a little quick intro of who you are, what you do at Toolpath, and we'll get started.
Yeah. Hey, Tim. I also consider you a friend, but for the rest of that, I'd say I'm more of a problem maker than a solver.
I'm trying to be nice.
And as far as visionary goes, I would say too blind to realize how hard of a problem I'm stumbling into.
Yeah, that's a blessing in a lot of ways.
But just a little bit about me, I guess. I started Toolpath after an 18-year career in NASA. Worked on some really cool stuff. We can talk about that if you want there at NASA. Yeah. That had almost nothing to do with machining. But I would say that's an adjacent skill set. And when my friend Andy, who I've known since college, called me up and was like, hey, let's do something. He originally wanted to do something based off that NASA tech. But for a bunch of reasons, that wasn't going to work for me. The biggest one being that I would have basically had to like walk away from an entire team of people that didn't know I was thinking about leaving because I wasn't. And I just couldn't do it to them. And so he had bought a Tormach and learned how to program it in Fusion and stuff. And he was like, could you just like automate the programming of this? So I went into a hole for a couple of weeks and did some like basic stuff and decided that the skills I had learned doing what I did at NASA would translate, albeit not exactly straight one-to-one, and that I had a chance of automating it. So, yeah, I was like, all right, let's give it a try.
Okay.
I'd say the rest is history, but I mean, there's a long, long road between that moment and where we are now. So
give me a rough time. You know, how long ago? So right now it's September 5th, 2025. Give me a timeline. Conversation happened.
I'd have to
make it up.
It was like just at the beginning of COVID. It's like, so 2020-ish.
Okay. That's interesting. I got all kinds of thoughts on that. So I think I'm going to nudge that a little farther down the conversation. Okay. I wrote down, and so I have some notes to kind of hopefully usher this through some kind of organized conversation. Like you and I have driven a few places together, and we have lots of darting, you know, tangent conversations. So I wrote down NASA tech. I want to learn a little bit more about that and how you thought that might, you know, be able to apply to what we do. And I meant to write something else down, but I forgot. So we're going to move on. Okay. So we're talking 2020. So we're close to four or five years right in there.
Yep.
And then I can say, I'm not here to blow smoke up your rear, Justin, but you've achieved a lot in 4 or 5 years.
Oh, thanks.
I definitely don't want to turn this into a love session, but I definitely don't want it to be about me, because I want everybody, my intent with kind of this series, I want to do like a get to know series. I think Toolpath has a lot of really awesome people. And I very often feel like more people should know who we are and kind of the people behind it. So we're starting with you. If this isn't a train wreck, we will continue it from here. But what I will say is I've been in the industry. It hit me the other day. I've been in the industry 25 years. I've used 7 CAM systems in industry, and 2 of them were supposed to be automating CAM. And 2 of them pretty much made me feel like CAM is not automatable. And this is coming from someone who's really tried to automate at least my thinking behind making parts. And I had probably one of the best jobs in the industry when I worked at Autodesk. And the first time I used Toolpath, I was like, it has a long ways to go, but it was the first time where I'm like, I think that kind of thinks like me. You know, it's teachable a little bit, right? It has a long way to go, like me.
I agree. You are also only a little bit teachable.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, it's nudgeable. You can kind of nudge it in a direction, right? So, I mean, that's why I hope it means a lot. I mean, I gave up what I really think was one of the best jobs in the industry to come kind of build the dream that you and Andy started. So I hope to have Andy on this soon. Okay, so moving along, I want to do a, we're going to see how this goes. I did it with Kevin Schneider recently from Autodesk. We're going to do a lightning round. And it didn't turn into be quite a lightning round because I like to ask a lot of follow-up questions. But we're going to try. And so let's see how it goes. You ready for it?
Yeah, shoot.
All right. So we're going to start with first CNC machine you ever saw in action.
I cannot swear that I saw it move, but the first CNC machine I ever touched and pressed buttons on was a Bridgeport in the tin building at Georgia Tech. With some sort of a two-axis, I thought it was a DRO, and I asked somebody, how do I turn this DRO on? And they said, oh, that's not what that is. It's a CNC control, two-axis.
Oh, that's so cool.
But the first real CNC machine I ever touched was, not including 3D printers, was a Shape Oko that I built at NASA in the makerspace. I got it to cut one circle out of a piece of plexiglass. And then set it aside, got busy, and never touched it again.
That's awesome. Yeah. That's great. That's a good story. I am tempted to ask follow-up questions, and I'm going to try to keep it a lightning round. First CNC machine you ever programmed?
Well, that would have been the Shape Oko as well. But the first real CNC machine I ever programmed probably would have... I don't think I wrote anything for Andy's Tormach, so I think it would be the Sile X7 here for... Toolpath.
Cool. That's awesome. The Sile. How do you say Sile? Always miss
Sile. Yeah, I think it's
Sile. Okay. Yeah. Like S-I-L-E is how it's pronounced? Okay.
S-I.
I know how it's spelled, but yeah. I'm a sounded outer guy. and that was the first CNC you bought?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I think we would have bought a Haas mini mill. We timed it very stupidly because, like, at the beginning of COVID, they were, like, giving them away. They would pay you to take one. But I had said that because, like, one of the ways that Andy enticed me to leave my job at NASA was like, oh, yeah, we'll buy a CNC machine and put it in your garage.
And you're like, done.
Yeah, pretty much. I don't know if he knew that was, like, on my retirement wish list, like, things that I was aspiring to.
Yeah.
And so that was like part of like the plan from the beginning with Toolpath. And I said, no, we should get to a point where Toolpath can program something before I buy a CNC machine, which like objectively I think was a good milestone. But timing wise, like we waited 8 to 9 months too long or a year too long. And so we went from like them giving them away to them being really scarce.
A premium.
Yeah. So I went to the Haas HFO, which is only 15 minutes from my house. And I was like, I'd like to buy a mini mill. And they were like, cool, that'll be 30 weeks out.
No way.
Yeah. And I was like, okay. And I think they wanted like $70,000 for it or something.
Wow.
And so Andy was like, well, check out this Sile brand. So I called them up and they were like, well, you can have it for $40,000 landed in your garage and it'll be here in a week and a half. You want it? And I was like, yeah, I guess I want it.
Yes. Awesome. How's that? Okay, I'm gonna write down Sile to try to keep this lightning round. I want to ask more about your experience with it, but we're gonna move on. So, this might first coding language you ever learned, and at what age?
Let's see. I would have been 10 or 11, maybe 12, and my friends were really into this programming language called BASIC. This will probably come up again a little bit later, but one of my good friends was really good programmer. Honestly, probably one of the best programmers in the world. And for some reason, like they were into it, so I tried to get into it, and I just didn't really take for me.
Okay.
And then my parents had bought me a Lego Mindstorm, which had some like really sort of visual programming stuff in it. And that didn't really take either. But I mean, I remember writing some like really simple DOS programs. Okay. The first time I wrote anything resembling real software was in high school, C++. Yeah. I wrote Pong for myself and like played it on the computer in the lab.
Awesome. Awesome. Yeah. I've heard BASIC. I've heard C++. BASIC was like wildly popular like pretty long time ago. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, back in the DOS days, yeah.
Okay. My grandfather's an old school programmer guy from, you know, Korean War times. So BASIC sounds very familiar. All right, lightning round. Well, what's the raddest problem you've ever solved with code? And the second part of the question is, you know, it's something you physically built. You know, bonus points if it was machined. So kind of two separate questions.
I would hesitate to say that anything I've machined has been rad. I'm proud of a few things I've machined, but they all are very simple from a machine.
I said problem you've solved for a reason.
All right. Programming-wise, the raddest problem I think I've ever solved was what I did at NASA. I'll just give you a little bit of backstory. It took 16 years and 14 years into 16 years. I was there for 18. It took 16 years, maybe I couldn't swear to that timeline, maybe more like 14 because there was a couple of years at the beginning of my career there, but something like 14 years before I felt like it had been solved. And then the rest of it was like iterating on improvements and expanding capability. Mm-hmm. About 15 or 16 years in, I gave a talk at an AIAA conference called How to Succeed at Optimization by Failing All the Time. And I remember proposing that talk. It was a keynote talk. I was really, really proud to give a keynote talk. And it was during during COVID, so it was all remote. The NASA guys were like, you can't title your talk failure. NASA doesn't fail. And I was like, you can't stop me, which isn't true. They could stop me. They just didn't know how.
NASA's failed a few times pretty publicly. So let's move on.
But
that's a sore subject. Sorry.
the problem was, I'll skip the nitty gritty details and just say it was designing really tightly coupled propulsion and aerodynamics for the airframe. I did not invent the methods that I used to solve that. In fact, my PhD advisor who taught me a lot and one of the other Toolpath members, Sandy Mader, also taught me a lot during that time because he was in that lab. They didn't invent it either, although they really perfected it and took it to a next level. But what I did was take what they were doing, which was for aerodynamics and structures. So like how a wing bends when it's under load and then kind of finds its like stable position. And then I applied it to airframes and engines. And in doing so, I did it in a way that opened up this process that was something that you really couldn't do without a PhD in many, many years working on a very specific application. And I opened it up and turned it into something. And I say I, like me and four or five other people worked on this for years. We opened it up and turned it into something that almost any engineer could use with a little bit of programming practice. At the beginning of that process, my future PhD advisor told me that what we were trying to do was impossible. And then through various stages of research, I thought it was impossible and he told me to keep going. Finally getting there one day, and I remember like presenting my thesis work and showing people what I had done and some people in the audience being like, uh-oh, everything is different now. And saying that to me afterwards, because what tends to happen, humans are, we're really good at rationalizing our current situation. So like for engineers, that means that they're really good at posing design problems in a context that fits the limitations of their design capabilities. So in other words, they won't design an airplane more complicated than they know how to design is really what I'm saying. A machinist, you know, like is really good at like machining a part in a way that they're really sure will work and very, very hesitant to like break out of that box and try something really different. And I just sort of I don't have that gene that like causes me to be afraid of things I don't understand. I'm too dumb to realize how dumb I am. And so I remember giving that presentation and a couple of people saying like, yeah, we have to do things a little differently now. And it was a moment where people switched from saying, what you're doing is too hard, nobody will ever use it, to that's so good that I have to use it, right? And so I think there could be like an analogy to CAM there, where early on in the days of CAM, machinists were like, nah, I'll just hand code it. It'll be easier. And then eventually, like as you know, 3D surfacing and parts got more complex, like you just, you can't make them without CAM. And so it's a little arrogant of me, but I feel pretty proud to have a moment in the engineering community in aerospace where I got to say I made a difference, and like people will solve problems differently because of how I built that software, which is really
cool. Awesome. That's awesome. I look forward to the day that people are saying that about Toolpath. I mean, it's the reason, you know, I came to Toolpath. So I try not to make these podcasts a Toolpath advertisement, but we both have invested our lives into this. So I look forward to the day that I got a text message from one of our favorite customers in Southern California that we've changed his life. You know, some of the things I just shared with him as a machinist and then what we're doing with Toolpath. And I mean, it's the reason I went to Autodesk. It's the reason I came here. So that's, I think that's why we get along so well.
And then you asked what the raddest problem I solved with machining was. I didn't machine it, but my boss at NASA had a shop in his basement, all manual machines. And my dad wanted a recumbent trike. And I had a certain way I wanted to design it. And there's the home builder fabricator way of like cutting up old bicycles and making it work. Yeah. And I was like, this is stupid. I don't want to do this. I'm not a good enough fabricator to pull it off. So I had him turn what's effectively a head tube and an upright on a lathe and make a couple of milled parts for me. Then I welded them up. And I actually still have those. The rest of the bike has been chopped up, but I have those in the basement. I have some uprights that worked for that trike. Yeah,
that's cool. And we've talked about this before. Was that an e-trike or just a trike?
That one was just a trike. I did build him an e-bike, but that was adding an e-bike to a normal recumbent.
Got it.
I think
it's
way too fast. It goes like 30 miles an hour.
That's awesome. If it's worth doing, it's worth overdoing, right? All right, favorite tool in your shop?
I guess it would depend what day it is. I have this LTT screwdriver, which I think is way overpriced, but also worth every penny. So I bust that out a lot. If we're not counting the machines, because otherwise it would be the Speedio. I would have to say my welder. It's just... Okay. Like the simplest Lincoln 175, Lincoln Electric Square Wave TIG 175. But I bought it. It was the first machine I bought out of college. When I left Georgia Tech, I was on a racing team, Rec Racing. And they had like, so I basically could do whatever I wanted. There was all manual mills and all of this stuff. There wasn't any CNC in there at the time. And I remember like walking out on my last day at Georgia Tech, like crying a little bit that I was losing access to this place and saying, I'll just build my own one day. And it took me a couple of years. We had bought a house and it took some time before we had any spare funds. And it was like an $1,800 welder. It weighs like 1,000,000 pounds. I somehow manhandled it into the back of my Honda Fit to get it out of the store. That was a bad idea. I should have just asked a friend to help me. I still have it. I don't weld that much anymore. At the time, I was going to build a tube frame car, like a Lotus Caterham 7 type car.
Yeah.
And that was like the goal of it. And then later on, it became building bike frames and things like that. But I would say that tool is my favorite, mostly because it was like the first tool that made me feel like a grown up, like, okay, I can buy my own tools and like build my dream now. Yeah.
We have a lot of parallels, Justin. I'm like the dumber, more handsome version. just kidding. I have a Lincoln 175, 1995, shortly after high school. I bought that cause I wanted to make bicycles. And, as you know, my spine isn't very healthy, but I'm sure the lower part of my spine is unhealthy from that stupid welder. Because it's still in my garage. It's made a lot of stuff, from bike frames to part of a Jeep. And yeah, I've taught, I don't even know how many people who've been like, oh, I've always wanted to weld. And I'm like, we're going out to the garage right now. We're going to learn how to weld. So that's fun. A lot of people don't even know what that machine is. I feel like it's 200 pounds.
Easily, yeah.
Of pure copper. Okay.
May be worth more in scrap than I paid for it originally now.
Yeah, right. It also, the way you said that, it also made me feel like, you know, I'm adulting, right? I moved out of the house right after, you know, I turned 18. I bought that with no plan of where to put it, how to plug it in, nothing. It was a really dumb purchase, but I'm glad I still have it. So, the LTT screwdriver, I hear about these things. They're like an internet legend, urban legend type thing. I have a very nice, similar Snap-on that I also probably paid way too much for.
This is nicer. It's nicer.
And give me the pitch.
I'll tell you the one thing that makes it work for me. So yeah. He reversed the ratchet system. Other ratcheting screwdriver I've ever had, you turn the thing in a way that is the opposite of the way my brain wants it to turn. Fixed it on this one. Okay. So it turns in the right direction. And really, like, other than that, it's all a bunch of details. Like, the force on the detent is really low on the ratchet. The bit storage is pretty nice. But it's, for me, the thing is the reverse. Okay. I would call it the correct direction for the ratcheting mechanism.
I'm 90% sure the Snap-on does the same.
The one they sell today doesn't. I checked.
No way. I wrote it down as a fact checker. I'll post it on Instagram when we're done. I do love it. So if it's anywhere in that same world, do you roughly know how much they are?
I think they're like $85.
Oh, yeah. I'm certain my Snap-on screwdriver was significantly more money. Well, only $20 a week or whatever, right? Okay. What's the biggest mistake you've made in software and machining? Two different things.
The one I made in software will take a little explaining, but I told you it took, I don't know, 14 years, something like that, to get the software to be where it was. About 5 or 6 years in, I had a student I was working with out of that same lab that I eventually went to go get my PhD in. And he figured out, like, we were really struggling. We had the basics of something kind of working. And he figured out that, to make a very long story short, that what we were doing, like, fundamentally was limited and was never going to work. And he spent 2 weeks trying to convince me of that, very politely trying to convince me of that, and that he had a different way of doing it that would work. And I remember very distinctly that we were in a room with a whiteboard, and he was writing on the whiteboard. And it clicked in my head finally. And he says that I went like ghost white, and I sat down, I was standing and I sat down in the chair, and he's like, are you okay? And he got really freaked out that I was like upset or going to like fire him or something. But I like in that moment I knew, okay, we have to throw out everything we've done and start over.
Yeah.
That was not the mistake, though. I got my team. It took a while. It took some convincing, but I got them to throw it out and start over. And so then a couple more years in, we had made a lot of progress. But for another reason, somebody proposed that we start over a second time. And the first time starting over had gone so well that even though this time I was like, I don't know, I don't think... But for non-technical reasons, I was like, okay, let's go ahead and start over, right? Like, let's see how this goes. And that was a big mistake for a bunch of reasons.
And that's not what I was expecting you to say.
Yeah. Okay. So it was the second reboot that I think was a mistake and ended up ultimately costing us probably 6 months to a year of progress.
Okay. Yeah. That's a big percentage of 15 years or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
I wrote down starting over as something I want to circle back later to, because this is the lightning round, but we'll see how good I do as circling back, because that has a lot of relevance, I think, in our industry now, right? Okay, still lightning round. We have, what, one, two more questions. If you can give 20-year-old Justin one piece of advice.
You wanted to know what my biggest mistake in machining was.
Machining. That's why we have you here. Yeah.
Every crash I've ever had. I only say this because I feel like my machining accomplishments are so, like, I've never done anything that mattered a whole lot in a machining context, in the sense of like the part had to work. I've made a few parts for customers that had to work, but nothing that was really hard. So, I don't feel like I have any like catastrophically awful mistakes to point to. But I will say that I've made a couple of like boneheaded crashes, especially when writing probing macros. They are really hard to like be good at. And a few times where I've been like, oh yeah. And I was really careful, like on the first run of something, or like I got 90% of the way through the macro and I'm like, cool, this is good. Turn the speed up. And then wham.
90% good is still not good.
So I don't know. I feel every one of those crashes. I had heard you once say, like, you don't crash a car, you shouldn't crash a machine.
Finish your sentence and I'll reply.
that stuck with me when I heard you say it. And I was like, okay, I need to, I mean, not that I took crashes lightly, but it changed my thinking on them of like, okay, I need to treat this like I'm driving a car. And so, yeah, I would say my original sin was like not really giving it the respect it deserved when you hit that green button.
Yeah. You know, life is my rebuttal to that. I've actually heard, I think I said that on the I'm going to promote Dylan's podcast in a minute, but I think I said that on Dylan's With Intolerance podcast, and I've had a lot of people mention something to me about that. Mostly like DM on Instagram. I'm so far from perfect. But the first shop I worked at, you crash a machine, there's a very high odds you're going to lose your job. And that's an extreme. That's too extreme. Right. And then I've seen people almost celebrate crashing machines. And I think similar to like crashing, let's say a race car, not a street car, but a race car, it happens. But you should learn from it. You should, you know, have a plan for how to not happen again and whatnot. So,
I take it back. I have a better mistake I made from machining, but only because you just made me think of it. I was really inexperienced, very obviously, when I first got that style. I had just bought a face mill. It's a 3-inch face mill, which is way too much face mill for a BT30 machine, and like more face mill than a novice should ever use, really. But it was like the only one left from the sale I was ordering or something.
Yeah.
I started chucking parts from the vise, like left and right. And for some reason, I just kept doing it, like throwing parts.
It should have just been left and then reassess. Yeah. Not left and right.
I mean, I was like trying to like dial back my feeds and speeds and my depth of cut, but I was just too inexperienced, and I wasn't. I had almost forgotten about that phase because it was like a 1-week phase of having my machine. Like early on, but I don't think I was like torquing the vise consistently. I think the size of stock I was using was changing a lot. So like what would work well on like a 1-inch tall piece of material, and then I'd throw like a 5-inch tall piece of material in.
Yeah.
And these are things like as an engineer, you'd think I would understand like torques and moments and stuff, but apparently I'm not smart enough to translate between disciplines. But I threw a bunch of parts, and I'm just lucky they all stayed in the machine. We can circle back and talk about that. Because it turns out that machine, as shipped, did not have impact-resistant glass. But
I'm glad you're still with us.
Yeah.
That jar to memory, I'm turning the lightning around, not so lightning, which is fine. So I've been doing a ton since my accident. I've been doing a ton of, you know, running things through Toolpath and having Carol run them in the machine. And It's interesting. I'm more careful with her preservation than my own, which is an interesting. I should go to counseling for that as I'm saying that out loud. But one of the things I've noticed that I've done, I still need to do. We call them Toolpath Chronicles at Toolpath, where we're running through parts, kind of learning from them, making tickets, kind of pushing the software forward. And I still, it's on my list of things to do early next week, but is to go through Toolpath Chronicles for, I offered anybody at Toolpath to run, design some parts. If they fit in with my, if you can make them with my tool library, if it runs through Toolpath and you can make it with the stock I have on hand, I'll make them. And Al Whatmo, our CEO, and Sandy, one of our other big brains, both took me up on that pretty quickly. And I think I'd have to go back and check. I think the main thing that I changed on both of them was on the second operation. I have a 2-inch face mill that gets after it. And I changed the step down to like 25 thou or something because I was holding on to it with some tiny little depth soft jaws. Because I have learned the hard way. I've seen parts come out of machines, 6 inches from someone's head. So, yeah. Anyways, moving along.
Before we go on, though, I want to highlight something you just said, because for me, this is a proud moment for that Toolpath has achieved something. And I think you inadvertently just took it for granted.
Okay.
You said that they could make it with my library.
Yeah.
They will know that before they ever send you the part.
That's yeah, I don't think I verbalized that, but I mean, I work a lot of late nights because I haven't been sleeping very good. And yeah, it was midnight that I kind of came up with this like idea. Like well, last several parts I ran just worked. And here was the other interesting thing I think that you're scratching at is earlier you said rationalize your current situation. One of my superpowers for the last 15, 20 years, I'm really good. I don't think I'm very good at much, but I am very good at designing things to match my manufacturing capabilities, right? And so I'm really good at making interesting parts with the set of tools I have. And I've been working with a couple schools recently that I'm kind of, this is great for engineers, right? You have a set of tools, Toolpath can help you realize that your stuff's machinable or not machinable. And I'll just get into more details on this specific one. Al took this part that's kind of a long time HSM, fusion part, and he had to make some design changes. It's a simple part, but it was from the CAM-ANIA part where our buddy CJ Abraham and Xander did when they were in high school. And he just modified the part to work with my tool library with the drill I had and all that stuff. And then what was more interesting to me was Sandy, huge brain software engineer, totally has learned an amazing amount about machining just in the year that I've been here. Now he has to design a part that works with my tools because it's going on my. I mean, it's not a super. I mean, it's a very expensive machine for me to have in my garage, and it's my problems to deal with if something goes stupid. And I was like, I don't think I would ever have imagined me being in a place to tell some software engineer in Canada, yeah, I'll make your part with almost no. I mean, I looked over everything, and it was like I would run this right now. I changed the tolerance because this 3D toolpath was going to run better on this with this tighter tolerance. It was the most awesome part for me was that he came back to me and was like, he asked me a couple just smart follow-up questions, and he made a couple smart design changes, and I'm the one that made the part to print. More
I also
detail to
I also made
that.
that part
Yeah.
with my tool library, and I think it's cool that I could just quickly switch to a completely different tool library. And I didn't
Yeah.
have exactly the right tools, but I made the part
Yeah.
close enough.
Yeah.
So
Yeah.
I don't. It's cool that we just sort of are taking that for granted now. That feels like a proud moment for me.
Yeah. So my last job at Autodesk was on the education team, where I spent a ton of my time mentoring vocational programs, things like Formula SAE and Baja teams. And it was amazing how much time I spent just helping like a Baja team understand why something wasn't machinable. And I felt like the hero because I was helping these super smart kids just understand what I saw was fairly basic stuff. And Toolpath just kind of did that by itself with Sandy. So it was really fun for me to see that happen. So thanks for chiming in on that. I think that was a good call out. We'll see how daring I get. I'm kind of a chicken in a lot of ways. I'm like too dumb to be scared of some things, and a chicken in a lot of ways. Like I have to have a couple beers to get up enough energy or enough over my shyness to do this podcast. But I'm thinking about doing an Instagram. I'll make your part for the public. We'll see. It's my. I never would have thought it would have, but the first couple went so smooth. Might do a webinar and I'll machine an Instagram part or something like that. So, last question. What is your go-to meal, when you're grinding late on a project? I passed out recently cause I forgot to eat and bopped my head. I got some staples in my stupid head. And you might have lectured me like a father or something like that. So share, I know the answer to this. So share your answer.
The answer you think you're going to get is Soylent.
Okay.
And there's a bit of a history there, but no, I would honestly, I would say pizza or ice cream. I
can't go wrong with that.
I'm not a thin guy, but I get crazy hungry when my brain is working hard, like really hungry. I can be not hungry working on a car for a couple of hours and then stand up and be like, oh, I'm starving.
How interesting.
But for some reason, when my brain is churning, my stomach is like, feed me. But Soylent is my go-to, like, I don't have time for this and I need to eat thing. Yeah. But it's not what I would choose to eat. But while I was doing my PhD at Michigan, I was actually commuting between Cleveland and Michigan. So I would live in Michigan for 5 days and then go home on the weekends. And I would do 15-hour days every day in Michigan.
Yeah.
And I rented an apartment or a room in a house with a couple of other guys. And I would leave before they woke up, go right to the lab. I would keep my Soylent at the lab. I would have that for breakfast and lunch. Usually we'd go out for dinner, like as a lab, or some people would go out for dinner. And then I would go back to the lab and work. They never saw me ever. And I never had any food in the fridge or anything. At this apartment, they were like, do you eat? Are you here? But I lived on Soylent during the week for breakfast, lunch, and many dinners for about a year.
You say Soylent like anybody on this call knows what that is.
It's like Carnation Instant Breakfast, but for tech bros. The quick backstory of Soylent that's kind of funny is there was a guy who had a startup making some calendar app, I think, and it wasn't doing well, but like eating got in the way of coding for him. And so he figured out that like he could order all the essential nutrients to keep him alive on Amazon in bulk. And so he started blogging his like journey of producing like a perfect food replacement. I don't know why Carnation Instant Breakfast or like the existing protein shakes didn't work for him, but they didn't. And so he spent months like doing this, and he did it all on the web. And eventually, weirdly enough, it snowballed into a big enough thing that his investors were like, stop doing the calendar app. You're now a food company.
And then the reference to Soylent is from what?
It's from some old Charlton Heston movie, Soylent Green.
Yeah.
Soylent Green was made of people. Yeah.
Yeah. We were at IMTS, probably working way too late, you know, last year, and you told me the backstory, and then two times, some sci-fi geek made some Soylent Green reference, where for the last 40 something years of my life, I would have just like nodded my head like I knew what they were talking about, and I'm like, I know what you're talking about. So that's a good one. That's something else we have in common. I guess the difference for me is I'm like a dumb dog, I think. I was raised on the back of my dad's motorcycle. If he wasn't hungry, little 5-year-old Timmy didn't need to eat. And I think he just trained me to not have to eat. There's been times in my machining life, especially when I had my own business, that I would go 16 hours without eating. My ex-wife would be like, are you stupid? You need to eat. And I think that's kind of what happened the other day when I passed out in the kitchen. Carol was like, wait, what's the last thing you ate? And I was like, I don't think I ate today. So I got in trouble for that. Now I'm getting fed better, which is not a terrible outcome of that. Okay, I'm looking through our notes. That's the end of the lightning round. So 30 minutes in.
Is that bad?
I think that's great. That was some good topics. Let me look to see. There's a couple things we'll come back to. Speedio. You're pretty happy with the Speedio?
I really, really like that machine. Mm-hmm. We're thinking about maybe getting rid of it and replacing it with a 5-axis, and it's going to be a tough machine to let go for sure. But I really enjoy running that machine. It sounds like it's crashing every time it changes a tool, and you almost can't get used to it. Almost. I mean, eventually you kind of become numb to it. And there are some quirks. The control has some quirks. It's kind of Fanuc like, but a little bit less of a pain in the ass to use. Honestly, almost every CNC control is like using a computer from 1982. It's really weird that's the, you know, like on the bamboo behind you, we're like, oh, the user interface is so good. And like my son can use it or whatever. But for some reason, we accept like the most insanely bass-ackwards control.
The term that is always used is military grade, that kind of, I think it's their excuse. Well, here's the deal. Like the Fanuc is, they measure their uptime in zillions of whatevers.
I know the story. I know the history. It's all BS.
Total BS.
Like my phone has more uptime, right? Like than all the season. Yeah. Like it just, you know.
It's total BS.
I get where it comes from, and I get it more having run parts and run machines, like the unwillingness to crash and all of that stuff. But like if you look at the bamboo, you realize that we're not actually beholden to this stupid system. We just like as an industry have chosen to allow ourselves to be. So and I think Datron really proves that point. Like their control is not a pain to use. So
exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Willingness to change. That's something I wrote down for our circle back at the end. I think it should be a good topic for us. While we're talking about machines, there's a Sile at the shop as well. Mm-hmm. Give me your 2 cents on that. I'm not asking you to sell any machines, but,
I have a love hate relationship with that machine. Love dislike. I don't think I hate anything on it. From a, like a mechanical point of view, that machine is way better than it has any right to be for 40K. An epoxy granite. I think the thing weighs 5,000 pounds. It's rich as heck. Even all the coolant and everything on it is fairly well sorted. It doesn't overflow very easily. The chip bin comes out of it easily. It's pretty accurate. I would struggle to claim that the Speedio is more accurate than the Sile. It's
okay.
It handles some big stuff. Mine, the one we have here, is only a single phase. But so the spindle runs out of guts pretty quickly. I think if I had bought a 3-phase, that would have been better. I didn't want to get a phase converter when we had it in my garage. That was actually one of the reasons the Sile made it onto the list. I think these days, the 1500 MX from Tormach did not exist. Those go pretty head to head, those two machines. I would have bought a 1500 instead of it. The dislikes on that machine, the control on it. I mean, I got the cheap Chinesium control because I didn't know any better. I'm not actually sure that was the wrong decision because the other options were a Syntec control, which is okay, or a Siemens control, like an 808D, which sounds like it would be like industrial grade, but the integration on that machine I've heard was not top notch.
Got it. I have a Kevin Schneider and two Kevins. Kevin Ellingson, two friends of mine, both have them. I think they were early Sile owners. I've got to go ask them what controls they have.
I will say this, ours is a 2021, which was like the first year of a new model, and the machine was much more refined.
Got it. Okay.
So overall, like very few complaints. Service, like if you need to have somebody out to service the machine, you're going to be in trouble. I mean, it can be done. There are people who do it, but it's not like a Haas guy where there's somebody down the street.
Yeah. Are they typically, they're hoping you're going to want to fix your own machine? Mm-hmm. Is that? Okay.
And they've been like, I've had like service calls on WeChat with Chinese engineers. Aaron, CNC repairman, has always been great. If you call Sile support, he picks up.
Oh, really?
Yes. Yeah.
Aaron, CNC repairman. Yeah. I did not. Why did I not
know
that?
He will literally answer the phone if you call their support.
No way. Yeah. I'm pretty good friends with Aaron. I'm bummed I didn't know that. That's good to know.
I like this. Thanks. To be honest with you, like almost all the time when something's broken, they're like, "We'll overnight you a part, plug it in yourself, and get it working."
No way.
So it's hard to complain about that. But if I was running a shop where I was like, I'm not taking it apart. I need you to come fix it. Okay, now we're talking a different level of problem. So I think it's a great starter machine. And if there was more service coverage, which there may be at this point, it's been a number of years, but I would not hesitate to recommend it. But if I was going to buy like a building full of machines, I'm not sure it's the one I would choose.
Yeah, I haven't heard them try to position themselves like that either. So, all great feedback. They probably moved up a notch in my book with Aaron. I'm a big fan of Aaron at CNC Repairman. And I'm a fixer of my own stuff guy myself. So that also moves him up a couple notches. What's the claimed horsepower on that?
I think it's 7 horsepower.
Okay. Okay.
There's no way it has 7 horsepower, at least not at 10,000 RPM, but
Okay.
I can stall it with a moderately deep cut on a 3/8 inch end mill in aluminum.
Okay. That's probably 3 horsepower.
Or at least bog it, but
Okay. I've been doing a lot of testing of cutting parameters and all that as we're playing with automating toolpaths, and I've been spending a bunch of time with, one of the co-founders, Andy, and that's been a fun journey for me. My background is most of the machines I've run had more horsepower than the tools that it could handle. So it's been a fun journey for me to like kind of rethink lower horsepower machines. So we should have a pretty well sorted out Tormach 770 library to share with people pretty soon.
I was disappointed to hear that the peak torque was at 4,800 RPM. I was hoping it would be 4,200 RPM, just to have 42 is the number. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Good. What's the significance on 42?
Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy reference.
Oh, that's another sci-fi thing, isn't it? okay. All right. Now we're going to move into, I call this like the life and kind of career storytelling side. So before we do that, I want to call out, Dylan's With Intolerance podcast. I don't want to repeat what we did and, you know, what you already shared in Dylan's podcast. Not that there isn't overlap, but I looked up, there's a really good, episode of that. It's episode 233. Check out Dylan's With Intolerance podcast. Personally, it's one of my most listened to podcasts. What we're trying to do a little different here is just kind of tell the stories a little different. I personally think more industry people should hear other industry people's stories. I've personally heard, I was on Dylan's podcast and I shared maybe more personal stuff than I expected to, but I had a lot of people reach out to me. They put me up because I'm, you know, an Autodesker and toolpather. They put me up on some pedestal like I was something special. And it was really good to hear from people like, man, you're way more normal than I thought you were, or whatever. I don't, obviously I duped them.
More normal.
I think I shared like my inferiority complex or something like that. And they were like, holy crap, I saw you as, you know, some hero machinist guy, which I'm definitely not. And I'm just too stupid to, you know, too dumb to just, you know better. So I always push forward. So I like to break our lives down and kind of pick up some patterns, right? So let's start off. So everybody go listen to Dylan's podcast. I would put it on your favorites, whatever list, but he does a really good job of teasing out people's stories. But with you know, kind of what you shared in Dylan's podcast, I would like to pick up something from your childhood, the kind of your early sparks, what first got you interested in making things or solving problems with code. I have this fascination where it hasn't been fascinating enough for me to commit to learning to be like a coder, but like, man, I want to solve some life problems with like some Raspberry Pis and, you know, stuff like that. And I just haven't been motivated enough because I got all kinds of other stuff to make. A Jeep to finish. And I think once I can be more mobile, so I'm playing with RC rock crawlers now as motivation, but, once I'm more mobile, my Jeep is high on my list. So let's dig into your childhood a little bit. So early sparks, kind of what interested, you know, what sparked you to be interested in making things, solving problems with code and software, stuff like that.
So I have to start by admitting that, weirdly, I have almost no memory of my childhood, or most of my life, actually. Occasionally somebody will say something or something will happen that'll spark a memory. But for the most part, if you go back even 6 months, I couldn't remember it. I remember a lot of the like bad things that happened in my life. And then I have a couple of like point memories. The very first Lego I built by myself, I remember, but only because I happen to still have it on my wall in my office at home.
Wow.
The reason I still have it is kind of a funny side story, but I built a lot of Legos as a kid, a lot of Legos. I'm not creative enough to build my own Legos for the most part. I really only like the kits. And when I was getting ready to go to college, I boxed up all of my Legos like pretty carefully in packing peanuts. And I put them in like this pretty big box. And then I wrote all over it, like Justin, like do not touch, dangerous. I put the poison symbol on it in Sharpie. And then I wrote like, call Justin if you find this box. And then promptly forgot that I had done any of that for like another 10 years. And then one day my mom called me. They were moving out of their house, my childhood house. And she goes, What the hell is in this box? The movers won't touch it. Like it's in the corner of this crawl space. They got there. They will not touch it. It says poison, call Justin. And it's got like the skull and crossbones on it. And I was like, oh, I think that's my Legos.
Don't mess with it.
She was like, God damn it. So she put it, she just grabbed the box and like threw it in the mail. I think she scribbled out the poison symbol or something. I had probably been married for 4 or 5 years and this box comes in the mail and I'm like opening it up and like out comes my Legos. And one of them was this little three-wheeled leaning trike thing. With like rubber bands on it. That's the first Lego that I remember building. I always really loved Legos. Middle school, I fell in love with the SR-71 Blackbird. I really knew like almost nothing about it, but it just looks freaking cool.
Badass.
And so I had, you know, that was like me wanting to go into engineering. That's what led me down that path, combined with some bicycle building that my dad and I did. We did go over that in Dylan's podcast. He called it my villain origin story because it snapped in half while I was riding it. And I picked up the two halves and like marched a mile home and like threw him down in front of my dad and glared at him to like challenge him. Cause we had to go on a 100-mile bike ride like a couple of days later. And I was just like, what are we going to do now, old man? And like 40 seconds later, he was like, all right, I'm going to go buy you a bike.
That's awesome.
But yeah, I would say bike building is what led me to engineering, and then race cars are what led me ultimately to an interest in manufacturing. Andy and I were part of the inaugural year of rec racing at Georgia Tech, which was this thing to compete in the grassroots motorsports $2,000 challenge. So $2,000 to build a car that could drag race, autocross, and concourse. And we had no freaking clue what we were doing, less than no clue what we were doing. Through just years of working on cars and doing a little bit of fabrication and a lot of fucking around, I sort of fell in love with the idea of machining. I did a little bit of manual machining to get a turbocharger onto a 1980-something, 85 BMW. Actually, Andy was part of that. We were at Pull Apart looking for a part for a BMW, and like the forklift guy, I don't know if you've ever been to a Pull Apart. They're not gentle when they're like moving these cars around the yard.
Yeah, they call them pick and pulls out and out here. But yeah, I think we're talking about the same thing.
Like the guys are like
wrecked cars where you're yanking stuff apart. Yeah.
And so like the guy's like driving this forklift, like chuck, like bouncing the car up and down, like on and off the forks, right? Like just couldn't care. And Andy's like, that's a turbo Audi. What do you mean? And he goes, I didn't know turbo Audi for shit. He's like, I bet there's a turbocharger in there. And we had been at Pull Apart for like 3 hours. Turbochargers do not last at Pull Apart in Atlanta like very long. Like they're gone the next day.
Probably many places, yeah.
So we went right over to that car and spent 2 or 3 more hours pulling that turbocharger system apart. I had snuck I always sneak a propane torch into Pull Apart with me just in case. It's not a good idea. Don't recommend it. Light the whole thing. You will light the entire place on fire if you're not careful.
Definitely not in California. I'll say that.
But I was like, you know, using the torch to heat up these rusty exhaust manifold bolts.
Okay.
And I had never touched a turbocharger system before. So I was like taking it one piece apart and putting it like back together in the, together in the wheelbarrow. And so we pushed the wheelbarrow up to the place and the lady's like, oh, that's a radiator, $5. And this is for our $2,000 car challenge. Yeah. I threw $5 at her and ran out of there so fast.
Can I get a receipt for that?
You got the receipt? I was like, sure.
Yeah.
So we loaded this thing in and we somehow managed to get that onto the BMW. This was in the early days of Megasquirt, if you've ever heard of that.
Okay. Yeah.
Engine management system. So we got Megasquirt on there. And this thing made we somehow found a different head to put on this block. I don't remember all the details, but it made 400 foot-pounds of torque at 3,000 RPM. It was nearly undrivable because it was this teeny little turbocharger on a pretty good sized engine. So it would spool up instantly. And it was basically a stroker motor. It was a 328 or something with the head we put on there made it low compression. Spent many, many hours making parts to get that turbocharger to bolt onto that BMW. I tried to convince the team to let me make a top mount intercooler because almost pure happenstance, if the intercooler that came off the Audi, if you laid it down, it lined up perfectly with the outlet of the turbo and the inlet. You would just need one elbow in both places, one elbow. And I was like, guys, we have to do this. Just cut a, it's a five, it's a $2,000 race car. I'm not modifying all this bodywork and spending money on tubing. I was like, just top mount it, cut a hole in the hood and put it up there. But it would have stuck the intercooler would have stuck a foot and a half up.
A blind spot.
Yeah. And they were like, it's going to look stupid. It's going to look stupid and you won't be able to see. Anyway, so we didn't do that, but.
That's funny.
I remember making turbo manifold pieces and flanges and stuff and all on a manual mill. But
that's awesome.
My descent into wanting to machine stuff and ultimately my goal of having a small machine shop in my garage. I don't know if I covered this on Dylan's podcast, but I went from I bought the welder to build this race car and I never built the race car. I did. The guy that you can go online and look it up, the car I was really interested in is called a Midlana, Midlana. It's a mid-engine reimagining of a Caterham 7.
Okay.
I had been reading this guy's blog because he had built another car called the Kim Mini, which was this badass mid-engine Mini Cooper.
Let's see how good our editor is and see if he can Google that and then splice in a picture. So keep going.
So I had been reading about the Kim Mini and then the Midlana, and the guy posted online at how crappy Microsoft Word was for writing books because he was writing a book about it. So I messaged him and I was like, I could help you do it with this thing called LaTeX, which is this old school typesetting software that I knew how to use from college. People use it for writing papers and stuff. And he like weirdly agreed to let me help him. And he sent me the whole book and I moved it over to LaTeX. And he eventually published this book. You can buy it. And I have an acknowledgement in it. I'm really proud of this acknowledgement. It's not awesome. For anything technical, like related to the car. It's just like I literally helped him like get the typesetting and done.
That's awesome. That's great. I'm 99% sure CJ, not probably surprising to you, he used that for some HSM support stuff.
Yeah.
It sounds very familiar and it's like the coder's way of handling problems like that, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Sorry for the interruption.
And fast forward, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years. And finally I was like, cool, I'm going to start building this car. I had a Miata that I was racing and I was going to turn it into, anyway, I was going to break the Miata down and use it as the foundation for this mid-engine thing. And so I decided that I needed a lathe to like start this journey, which was completely irrational. I did not need a lathe.
Everybody kind of needs a lathe.
So I bought a, what's that?
Are you talking Smithy?
No, it's a little CNC, I think, or something is the website.
Okay.
Anyway, it's basically one of the biggest sort of benchtop lathes you can get. I can't remember any of the website. If I could remember the name, I'm sure it'd ring a bell. Anyway, I bought it, had it shipped to the house, set it up on the table, on the workbench. And then like 3 months later, decided I was going to go get a PhD and basically didn't touch it for like 4 years. So I had a lathe even before I joined Toolpath,
Anything with it before PhD?
Before PhD?
Yeah, before. So you got it, you set it up. Did you make anything before you went off and got distracted with your PhD?
Very like little basic problem, like very basic stuff. I turned some bike parts. I made some washers. Sharon needed something, my wife, for an art project. Nothing of any kind of meaningful note. Yeah.
Cool. Okay. So life and career story. That's the section we're in. The next one was hands-on years. We just covered the next one, which was great because that happened naturally. The next topic would be transition into software engineering. You know, what pulled you in that direction? That's a significant direction change.
It's not as significant as you'd think. The irony is, I'm a pretty good engineer. I'm not a great engineer. I'm a pretty good engineer. I'm a much better software developer. And somehow I never figured out that I liked software better than I liked engineering, even though my favorite classes were programming classes. And even though my best friend was all into programming and was doing it all through middle school and high school, and somehow I just never clicked for me. I always thought I wanted to be an engineer, not a programmer. But then I went to work for NASA, and this would have been 2004, 2005. And I got there and they're like, cool, sit in this chair and use this piece of software called NPSS, which it's basically C++, but it's C++ software specifically for designing jet engines.
Got it.
And it's very hard to use, very challenging to use. You have to be a pretty proficient object-oriented programmer. You have to understand something called a Newton solver, these like nonlinear mathematical solvers. I liked programming. I just didn't know I liked programming, or I liked programming enough to be really good at NPSS. Like really good. Like other people in the office who had been there for years and years and years were like mad at me because I picked up NPSS and they were still struggling with it. People who could teach me a lot about jet engines, but were struggling to use NPSS.
Yeah.
And I just, from there, I never really left the software world. Everything I did at NASA was really writing engineering software. I went from NPSS to this other software that we built that we talked about at the beginning called OpenMDAO. I ended up, I swore I'd never go back to school after I graduated undergrad. I really hated it. I really did not enjoy my last few years at Georgia Tech. I love my time in rec racing, and I felt like everything they taught me the last few years in engineering was worthless. I think in retrospect, that's maybe unfair, but only in part. The curriculum, I was there at a bad time where the curriculum needed an upgrade and an update, and I was right at the tail end of a very old curriculum. I loved coding and I never really left from there.
So perception and reality are often interesting, you know, separate things. I don't have a PhD. I'll leave it at that. And I would have made the assumption that anybody with a PhD would have loved, or at least had a pretty positive experience with their undergrad.
Well, so the path there for me was kind of weird. So I swore I'd never go back. And then NASA had a program that would cover master's tuition. So I was like, well, I'm not doing engineering. I have no interest in that. So I went and got a master's in computer science, and I loved it. I thought it was great. I really enjoyed it. The first AI class I took was in that course. So that goes back to like 2010 or something.
Got it.
2011. And I only know that because my wife recently reminded me that after, like, the place where I was taking lectures was across the street from the hospital where my wife had just given birth after 27 hours to my son. And I was
sounds like my daughter's birth. We have a lot of parallels. Keep going. Keep going.
I was like, cool. He's here. You guys are good. I'm going to go sit in this lecture. I'll be back in a couple hours.
Damn it, Justin.
I don't remember
text
that.
Me.
But
next time you're at that fork in the road, text me and I'll advise you differently.
So she reminded me of that recently. But so that's why I know that was 2011, but because that's when my son was born. But so I went and got this computer science degree and I loved it. And then I finished that and I told Sharon, if I ever ask you if I can go back to school again, punch me in the face. Just say no. But then I was doing this stuff at NASA and I started working with a couple of professors in this field of optimization who I really, really liked and respected a lot. And I, to this day, I do not know if they like got together in a room and coordinated this or not. I don't know. But like within 3 months, each one of them had pulled me aside and been like, you need to go get a PhD. Come do a PhD in my lab, like, please. And it was extremely flattering. And I remember thinking and saying to them, like, guys, I'm not smart enough to do a PhD. I don't think I could do this. And they were like, listen, asshole, it's not up for debate whether you could do it or not. Just come do a PhD.
Just do it. Yeah, that's awesome.
And then finally, the Keem, the professor who would eventually become my advisor, like took me up, bought me a couple of drinks and was like, listen, you're going to come do a PhD. Everything you're doing is like you would just get one. Like you just need to like do nothing other than what you're already doing and you would get a PhD.
That's cool. So
and that was absolutely the right decision going into Keem's lab, working with Sandy and some other folks named Graham and Gaetan.
So
John Wong really taught me a lot, but so I also didn't think that I would ever be able to get a PhD, but I was told otherwise and apparently they were right.
Maybe it surprised you. Maybe it doesn't, Justin, but nobody's ever told me I should get a PhD. and that's where you met Sandy?
I had met Sandy during NASA. So like during our work with NASA, I was actually like the, what's it called? Like the contract manager for their work on a research grant. And then I had to, you know, recuse myself from that to go become a student in the lab where Sandy was now my, you know, my senior person in the lab.
And who is Sandy, Justin?
Sandy Mader. He's one of the developers here at Toolpath. But before that, he worked for a cool company called Spaceride. So believe it or not, Toolpath is not his first manufacturing experience because he had to have a bunch of parts made while he was at Spaceride. But they didn't have any internal manufacturing. And so he could tell his story much better. But there are lots of stories of them struggling to get parts in a short lead time or having DFM trouble or not understanding why everything was so expensive. That was his first real manufacturing experience, was just like sort of being in a company that needs parts made and kind of like throwing them over the fence and not, you know, struggling to get it back. That was a Canadian startup called Spaceride, defunct, but a cool company that was going to like launch rockets off of balloons, like weather.
Oh, that's cool.
But before that, he worked at University of Michigan under Keem Martins and doing cool optimization stuff.
Cool. That would also probably explain why I enjoy... I've worked with a lot of smart engineers over the years, and I particularly... Not that I don't enjoy working with other people at Toolpath, but he's one of the ones I hope to get on this get-to-know podcast and get to know him better, because he's a neat person. I love working with him. So I had why PhD written down, and we covered that. So now let's get into before Toolpath, some highlights, key roles. I think we covered some of this. Maybe lessons, some of the fun stories. How does that sound?
Yeah, sure. Before Toolpath, anybody who works with me at Toolpath, or really probably anybody who works with me ever, will not be surprised by this, but I was a real pain in the ass at NASA.
What?
But apparently I was worth it to people around me. A couple of times somebody put their neck out for me in a big bureaucracy. Sometimes that's what it takes to give me an opportunity. The first one was in 2010, the software that I'm really proud of, OpenMDAO. The original sort of foundation of that software was led by somebody else. I was just a junior engineer fresh out of college working on it. But 2 years in, when I'm still a junior engineer, Cindy retired, and she went to our joint boss at that point and said, I think you should give it to Justin. Let him lead it. It was like on paper an absolutely horrifically stupid idea to give this 22-year-old kid this software project with like a multi-million dollar annual budget, this team of people, this very complex topic. Also, by the way, a project that was like universally disliked at NASA that nobody wanted to touch with a 10-foot pole.
Interesting.
For all kinds of bureaucratic and political reasons. And my boss, like, he could have done the easy thing and like handed it to one of the other more senior engineers who probably would have let it die or let it languish. But he was like, nope, we're going to give Justin a try. And he ran some top cover for me. I think it was possible, only possible because it was a project that nobody wanted. So there was no like fight when he assigned it to me. But so that was a cool moment.
Interesting.
You know, NASA is one of the few places where you can make almost no progress and still be considered successful. Sometimes that's what foundational research is just banging your head against the wall again and again and learning a little bit more about the problem. And so I would say the other lesson I learned there was really how to fail fast. And it became very clear to me one day, much later in my career, 15 years in, when we were working on this project that now had been stood up, not around my work, but coincidentally, I was part of it, to be like a tech incubator at NASA and to get us to be more nimble. And they were like, how do we, you know, encourage failure? Failure is a dirty word. Like, we need people to fail, but not be upset that they failed. And I was like, I fail all the time. You guys don't seem to give two shits. What's the problem here? And they all turned and looked at me like aghast. And I wish I was being a little bit dramatic, but like, I don't have any tact. And in a meeting full of like senior people where I was supposed to be like there to answer questions if anybody asked, I was like, I fail all the time and you guys don't care. What's the problem? And they were like, what are you talking about? Your project is one of the more successful research projects. And I was like, yeah, because I fail all the time and I stop what I'm doing and change direction. So we got into this like really deep discussion, and like one of our outside consultants on innovation was like, what if we don't call it failure, but we call it alternative success? And like, I was like, you're not calling it that. That's the dumbest thing I've ever heard. Like, it's important to take a moment and stop and say, this is not working. I need to do it differently. I think that moment of pause of like, no, this is failing, is like the critical insight that I learned of like, guys, like, we can keep smashing our face into this, or we could take what we learned and go do it right. And you can see that sometimes in machining. I like Dylan once said, he's like, I spent too much time trying to tab off parts when I could have just done a second op. Like, right? Like, that's a failure moment. And like, how many times do you have to do it before you just admit to yourself, like, okay, look, tabbing off is cool, but like, this is going to be a fail. I'm in it, right? So,
Let me talk about that for a second. So you asked me maybe 2 days ago to share some knowledge on tabbing. So what was the topic? Tabbing and picture framing, right? And I was like, So internally at Autodesk, I mean, at Toolpath. So I pulled up an example and I'm like doing a little Loom video and I was like, I would just soft draw this sucker. And then I was like, I got to have an authentic, I have this stupid obsession with being like genuine and authentic. And I was like, got to have an authentic example. So I have this freaking hood that I 3D printed for my rock crawler, my little stupid RC car. And I was like, oh, that's a good picture frame example. And now I think I'm going to make the dumb thing on my machine where I just printed it and it's been totally fine. But that goes back to, our industry is, that's a really good kind of thought exercise for our industry, right? Is we do have a situation in our industry of like, when you're a hammer, everything's a nail. Picture framing parts, tabbing parts is just a wonderful workflow when applied even close to appropriately, where I see people like unlock some magical universe with it. And then like you look at everything they make, it's tabbed and picture framed on a 3-axis machine sometimes. Right. Yeah. So I'm glad that popped up because I have notes to share with, the Toolpath team. And then I like crossed out a couple things and I wrote, like, I don't remember what I wrote, but it was basically like, just do it when soft jaws don't make sense. When you're, $10 pair of soft jaws, right? That's too long of a tangent, but yeah, anyways. I really went off on a tangent on that one. So get us back, Justin.
So, I mean, like lessons I learned in my career. But I really think like my unique, and I spent time at NASA trying to convince people to be more like this. I failed at doing that. They didn't adopt that idea in NASA, but I said like good ideas should grow and bad ideas should shrink. And sometimes like basically like the faster you can recognize a failure, the less impactful it will be or the more successful you'll be. Right. So don't wait until you're on your fifth to draw the same analogy. Don't wait until you're on your fifth part, scrap part. Cause the tabs keep breaking or there's a rigidity issue. Like, just soft jaw it. And I've gotten so much pushback of like, no, you need to keep going. Or like, we're really deep into this research. And look, it's a little hard to draw a clear line. Sometimes you do need to push through and persist. But I think, I guess one of my unique skills is really being very sure of when we've reached the point of failure well before it's like completely and totally obvious. I will highlight that one of my biggest mistakes was restarting the entire software stuff too soon. Right. So nobody's perfect and I've screwed it up. And so, sometimes you have to take your losses in a painful way, your learnings in a painful way. But I mean, just being willing to admit like, hey, I was going to make this 5-axis part this way and it's not working. I'm going to do something else. Or we're going to build this AI cam system. And this idea I had for this algorithm that happened to Sandy and I, like we spent 3 weeks trying to implement this fancy algorithm that I was so sure was going to work and it felt like the right approach. And then finally we got to it and we're like, actually this, like fundamentally we missed something and now it doesn't work. So we have to go back and try something different. Fail fast. Like the faster you fail, the more successful you'll be.
I think what I add to that in the machining world, right, is like understand the consequence of failure, understand the cost, understand the potential reward. I think I only imagine, after Apollo 13 or the Challenger at NASA, like their risk, their acceptance of risk, change or the culture maybe changed. When you plow your spindle hard, in a machine shop, like you rethink, many people rethink kind of how they look at things. Where like I've always gotten to like, I could play with this work holding and that could open up this door and the risk isn't that high. Like, yeah, I'll take that chance.
NASA,
just kind of think through things like that.
NASA learned the wrong lessons from all of those things. They became too risk averse. And I think that translates to machine shops. What NASA ended up doing was saying, you can never fail, period, ever. Do not fail. Yeah. Be sure this will succeed. Look, it just doesn't exist. You can work really, really hard at making sure every last little detail is perfect. And then you launch your rocket and you realize, oh, shit, a piece of foam fell off and hit a wing in a way I didn't think about. And now it blew up. What you said before was think about the consequences. The right approach is to design a process where you mitigate the consequences of failure. Launch rockets without people in them. run parts in aluminum before Inconel, run things at 10% rapids, even though it takes forever, but it's, you know, you can afford to take the risk, take smaller depths of cut, even though you could in theory cut faster. You know, but if you're worried about rigidity, then like, what's the bigger consequence of failure? An extra 20 minutes of milling or a scrap part? Like, which would you rather have?
Yeah, I think about work. The topics I brought up with NASA, I've talked with NASA people when I was like an L3, and it changed the culture, right? It changed the culture at NASA. It's not the most popular topic to bring up in that audience, but I think it's a good example. And when I think about, you know, risk, what I see, you know, our sweet spot right now at Toolpath is like that, you know, that job shop that's, you know, turned over a lot of parts. And the way to be successful there is like figure out a process that you can repeat with confidence, right? And breaking away from that and like evolving to better and better and better is this real balance of, you know, let's just talk about, you know, I've never used Mighty Bite work holding before. And man, what if it doesn't, you know, I hear people like, what if I make this fixture and it doesn't work right? You know, I just think through like, okay, well, you know how to make that part and you could potentially save a lot of like hand, you know, labor hours. You know, just think through like, you're not going to blow up your spindle, you know, think through that consequence. You know, it's like, it's a little bit of money and some time, but some potentially huge unlocking, you know, gains. And that's that like risk versus reward. I worked with a good amount of NASA engineers on the GOES, you know, GOES-R satellites and stuff. So I talked to them and they were talking about the risk of these satellites not pinging back to Earth and all that stuff. So
can I tell a NASA side story there? It's right at the end of my
please
time.
Please do. Yeah.
So
this crosses off my good stories bullet point.
So right as like the tail end of my NASA career, I spooled up a small project to test airplane batteries with a very, very specific goal in mind. I don't know if you've ever flown in a 787. But like the more modern an airplane is, the more its wings bend up in flight. So if you think of like a B-52, and a 787's wings, like from on the ground to in-flight at cruise, they move like 25 feet, the wingtips. It's a lot. And so I put up a picture of that on the screen in front of NASA planning people. And I said, because they were talking about putting batteries inside the wing. And I was like, how much can you bend a battery? And they're like, I don't know, like not a lot. We don't know, but not a lot. Yeah.
Something close to nothing.
And then I said, but you want to put batteries in wings. And then I flipped to this picture of the difference between on the ground and in flight. Yeah. I was like, that wing moves 25 feet. Cool. And then everybody was like, well, but it's over this wingspan and it's not bending a lot. And I was like, cool. Are you confident that we can put a battery in this wing and bend it a little bit, just a little bit? And they're like, no, we'll have to
wrap it in Vaseline.
They're like, we'll have to make the battery small enough so that it could pivot and the wing can bend around it. And I was like, guys, if you put thousands of pounds of stuff in a wing that could be structural and is not structural, you did it wrong. And they're like, yeah, okay. So they're like, well, we don't know how much a battery can bend. And I was like, huh, seems like a good problem for NASA to investigate then.
Yeah, so that's awesome.
There's a machining tie-in here. So they were like, cool, go figure out how much you can bend a battery. So a couple of people, we like put together just a toy battery. It didn't matter if it was a good battery or bad battery. They made up a thermal management system for it. It didn't matter if it was good management or bad management. It just needed to be something. And then we were going to put it in a literal bomb box, like an explosive, because the battery might blow up.
Yeah.
And then attach it to like a hydraulic ram and just bend it until the battery blew up. Like that was the plan. That was it. That was the whole plan. And so we're doing a design review for this battery. Remind me at the end and I'll give another manufacturing tie-in. But we're doing a design review for this battery. And because of all of the explosions and some that had happened, there's a very good safety culture in NASA that basically anybody can raise their hand and sort of stop the system and basically be, I think this is unsafe, right? And basically anybody can cause that process to stop and you have to evaluate it. And so we did a structural analysis, and there was some bolt in this thing that was like had a safety margin of like 1.2 or 1.5 or something, which is less than the like safety factor of 2 that you normally want on flight hardware. This isn't flight hardware. This is in a test, and it's in a bomb box. Like, and they were like, well, what if it fails and the battery explodes? And I was like, that's the point. But I
make sure we're filming it.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I was like, I don't care if it explodes. And they're like, what if it doesn't explode? And I was like, then we'll light the, we had a button you could press to make it explode. So you don't want like a, maybe it'll explode situation in your hands.
Yeah.
I was like, then we'll, you know, then we'll detonate it.
Explode it.
And then I'll fix the bolt and I'll build another one and we'll try again. And they're like, no, we have to stop and redesign this whole thing. Even though we had already built like most of it, redesign this whole thing. Let's delay the test by 4 months. And I showed them the math. I was like, it is literally 3 times cheaper if you count all the time, the people's costs, the like our ability to go into this test cell, to just try it and see if it works. And if it fails, fix it. And if it doesn't fail, great. We'll go on to the next iteration. Then to do this safety review. And there's no risk. There literally no risk. It's in a bomb box. But I could not, because of the bureaucracy, nobody was willing to sign off and override the safety review. So we had to go back and redesign it with a higher factor of safety. So
and that ties in, to what I was saying, understand the risk and the reward and all that. Yeah. You told me to remind you the other manufacturing time. Yeah.
So, this battery was about 10 inches long, 4 inches wide. Basically just a rectangular box, 10 by 4, with some features in it. Obviously it was hollowed out, so that you could fit the battery in. So 10 by 4 kind of shell bolted together. So 10 inches by 2 inches, two pieces kind of bolted together. And then on the back of this 10 inch by 4 inch thing, there is like a 12 inch sort of tall square flange. And so he, you know, one of the engineers designs this thing, and sends it to Xometry. And they get a price back of $5,000.
$1 billion.
and they're like, cool, we'll just buy it. And they spend $5,000 on it. And this all happens before I had taken a look at anything. And I remember they show it to me and I was like, is that flange bolted on to the box? And they were like, no, why? And I was like, could it be? And they're like, sure, but why? And I was like, because then it's $300 instead of $5,000. So they had to find some guy with some big machine to hog this. I don't know. I don't know if it would have fit on a UMC 500. I think it's right at the limits. You're probably at a 750 or a 1,000, right?
Yeah.
And some dude was just hogging material off this giant chunk of aluminum, which I get it. Sometimes you need it. But in this case, like the steel bolts would have been stronger than the aluminum's anyway. So like there's a DFM situation of engineers just not thinking like, oh, maybe I should take these two really sort of dissimilarly sized chunks of aluminum and bolt them together rather than making it out of one piece.
I look forward to the day that that becomes an easy discovery for the engineers, right? So now we're going to switch to... we lightly talked about it, but you're switched to Toolpath. So we talked about Andy coming to you. Well, I think I want to dig a little bit more into NASA's a cool gig. Big brain, super geek, lots of problems to solve, lots of things to scratch your geekness. And probably felt like a very stable, like I could do this till I'm dead or retired. I don't feel like you have that same comfort, at Toolpath in the last 4 or 5 years. So talk about maybe from that angle, like that's a big leap.
NASA was more cushy for me than I think even you've painted the picture of it. I had... Okay. Sort of crested the wave. OpenMDAO was a big success. My career was sort of riding on top of that success. I was sort of being put in charge of more bigger stuff. I was gaining more influence. I was having a good time most days, although I was transitioning to this part of my career where I was less a doer and more a manager, but like more a bureaucrat is what I would really say.
Yeah.
And so I was starting to feel like that wasn't super fun anymore, but also like if I didn't do the management, I was afraid of who they would put in place. And I just didn't feel like there was a great alternative. So I definitely had days where it wasn't great, but I mean, especially in Cleveland, you're 100% right. A super secure job, although, you know, 4 years later, maybe even that assumption has to be questioned. But at the time it felt like, you know, and I absolutely thought that this is where I was for life. I loved where I worked. OpenMDO was a big success. I thought I could, there is another 20 years of work to like the next OpenMDO and continue to refine this optimization stuff. I still believe that there's a revolution coming for optimization in manufacturing. And I'm like right now today, I can't say much about it other than to say that there are airplanes flying today that are designed using my software that would not exist without that software, right? And so 20 years from now, that'll be every airplane would be like that. And I was looking forward to sort of being a part of that. I don't like to brag, but I had a very successful NASA career, like much more than I deserved, right? Especially for my age and the way NASA works and things like that. Before I came to Toolpath, there were two times in my life that I considered leaving NASA to go do a startup. One time was much earlier in my career. I got passed over for a promotion at NASA. I'll skip all the details and I'll just say, like, I felt really screwed over. Like really, really screwed over. And I was very unhappy. And I actually went and did a job application at a local biomedical engineering software startup. I didn't get the job because I didn't know how to interview for tech jobs at that point. But had I gotten that job, I think I would have left NASA and gone to work at this imaging startup. I was very unhappy. Obviously, I got through that, recovered. And then in 2019, right at the very, very beginning of COVID, right before Toolpath kind of became an idea with Andy and I. Your video froze on me. I'm just making sure you're still there. Yeah, you are. Okay. Another startup recruited me as actually one of those same professors who I had worked with before and who was like, you need to go get a PhD. You can come do one with me. A lot of respect for him. Long history, long working relationship with this professor. And he asked me to come join his startup as their optimization guy. It was a really exciting opportunity. And had I not been required to move to California, I think I would have done it. No, I don't mean to throw shade at California, but I just like, I went out there to the Bay Area and I was like, I could make millions of dollars from this startup and be more poor than I am in Cleveland. So
I was going to ask what part of California, because California is very broad. Yeah.
The Bay Area.
Okay.
But it was a really exciting opportunity to commercialize the tech I was working on at NASA. And I didn't know if that was ever going to happen any other way. So I really strongly considered it. But I just couldn't do that to Sharon and Eli. It didn't feel like the family life we were going to have. And financially, it didn't feel like there was like value in it kind of because of, and maybe I was wrong about that. I don't know, but the housing costs in California and like the thought of like locking my wife and child in a little apartment, my vibrating 7-year-old kind of scared me. I didn't take that job. And then, I don't know, 6 to 8 months later, Andy was like, let's do something. And then Toolpath kind of came about from that.
That's cool.
But I didn't jump right in. I actually worked for NASA and Toolpath for a year and a half.
I'm not sure I knew that.
And at first it was full-time NASA and part-time Toolpath. And then it was full-time NASA and full-time Toolpath. And then at the very end, it was part-time NASA and full-time Toolpath.
And then full-time Toolpath and full-time Toolpath. Grinding hard for a long time.
It took me a year and a half to get the team of people that I was leaving behind to the point where I knew that they were going to be able to handle the project. And I cared about that because I wanted the project to succeed, but also because, I mean, I had worked with these people for a long time and I just wasn't going to walk away and leave them without the ability to continue doing the work. So,
yeah, cool. So that's great. Moving on to the next bullet point. Let's have some fun. So you have a couple, it doesn't have to be fun, memorable, a couple memorable experiences, one or two memorable experiences from, From Toolpath. So this could go a lot of directions. I'll let you choose the direction.
One that stands out to me very clearly, honestly, like I flash back to it every time I press the cycle start button on the Sile. Like we ordered this machine and Andy, like I had never even run Andy's Tormach at this point, I don't think. I'd seen a Tormach, I'd seen some Haases, but I don't know, this was a 5,000 pound machine. And I thought I was like, you know, getting a real CNC machine. Like, yeah, real. And so I called the riggers and I was like, yeah, can you bring it in my garage? And the riggers were like, yeah, we're going to bring our smallest forklift. And I was like, damn it. Damn it. You ruined it for me. So they forklift this thing into my garage. And I plug it in, I wire it up, get air to it. Like I was ready, man. Like the second that thing had landed, I like shoved the plug in to the wall. And I powered it on and I'm staring at it and I am thinking, now what? There's all these buttons on this thing. I didn't even know how to load a damn tool into the damn thing.
Wow.
And Andy was like, I think you just call up tool 9 and then put it in the spindle. And I was like, okay, I'll do that. Right. T9 M6, like even just figuring out MDI.
Yeah.
I think very luckily there was like one or two YouTube videos online that got me the absolute basics of using the control. And so, yeah, I like very viscerally remember standing in front of this machine thinking, what have I just done? This thing will never come out of my garage. unlike your machine, mine eventually did leave my garage. Yours, I don't think will. But...
mine, I hope when I move, I hope I can find a machinist person that will appreciate a 8,500 pound machine that is significantly taller than the door that it came in.
you have the pool table problem, but worse.
But much worse. Yeah, I can find people that like the pool table. Yeah.
But I remember thinking this.
Thanks for bringing up that anxiety.
This thing will never be coming out of here. I have no idea how to run it, and I'm probably going to kill myself using it. Right. And so almost every time I press that button, I still think back to that moment. I got the tool setter set up.
That's cool. That's a good memory. I like that.
I got the tool setter set up and then like promptly rapeted like a drill like right into the Saunders plate I had on the machine. Yeah, I remember that. So those were early memories. We worked, Faye and I worked. Faye was actually like one of the very first hires at Toolpath. Almost a year and a half to generate G-code for this one Lego brick. You know, I machined like five. I don't even have one on my desk. I can't believe it.
What?
I must have given them all away or something.
That's disappointing.
But it's just a simple 4x2 Lego brick. And, you know, not a complicated piece, but man, were we trying stupid. Like we were writing our own adaptive roughing code at that point. You know, it was a terrible idea, an awful idea. But also we almost pulled it off. It was still an awful idea, but like we got way closer than we had any right to be. And so just like automating all this stuff. And I remember the first time we posted G-code and I could run that Lego. I remember that. That was cool. One of our early investors was like, I never want to see this Lego ever again after the millionth time I showed it to him. And I was like, I made it. I made the Lego.
That's awesome. I am going to be making one. That's awesome. So I can only imagine taking on essentially a toolpath, adaptive style toolpath. I can only imagine there was a lot of lessons there. Yeah.
We don't have time to go over them all.
Like, I can't actually imagine.
So many lessons.
Is the answer.
And we were just doing everything wrong. We weren't working with continuous parametric surfaces. We were working with only meshes. We were deriving things from like first principles, like fundamental assumptions of how we should and shouldn't work. We had to come up with like mesh smoothing algorithms. Like it was the worst idea ever. And like a lot of it ended up in Faye's PhD thesis.
That's cool. That's super cool. I'm going through a couple things. I wrote down Tinkercad. So this is a little bit of a callback. I wrote down Tinkercad because my daughter's pretty creative, but when it came to Legos, she wanted instructions. She wanted a layout. And Tinkercad, it's a free Autodesk product for anybody. Not that I'm here to pimp Autodesk, but they have a freaking blocks builder. You can bring in like a mesh of a dragon or whatever, and it'll build up a Lego, you know, Disney Lego land or whatever it is. They do that. I'm just crossing off a couple notes before we move on. Okay, so we're going to, you know what? Something that stuck out to me. You said best programmer in the world. One of possibly the best programmers in the world was one of your buddies.
I did.
That's a statement.
So
tell me more about that.
I'll try to make it quick because it's a little bit of a long story. But
yeah.
When I was growing up, I'm PhD. I'm a smart guy. I'm so smart that people ask me to come to a PhD. I don't say that to brag.
Yeah.
I say that to emphasize that my buddy Adam makes me look like an idiot child.
Wow.
Like he ran out of math to learn in middle school. And I don't mean it in the school. I mean like in math. Like there was no more to learn. At this point, you must invent your own math going forward.
That's awesome.
Really into programming. And somehow I just never got into it with him, even though we were hanging out all the time. I thought what he was doing was cool, but I was like into Legos and building bikes and stuff. So freshman year of high school and sophomore year of high school, freshman year he was in high school with me. Then he went off to this private school for really smart people. And he came back end of junior year, sophomore year in the summer, and he showed me this program. Now this would have been like 2000. So like you might not have had like high speed internet in 2000. Most people wouldn't have.
I did not.
Right.
Yeah.
But he showed me this program that him and his buddy had written that like looked at what your friends were downloading off Napster and suggested music for you. And he was like super proud that like on a dial-up connection, he had downloaded like 50 gigabytes of music overnight or something, and that he liked to listen to all of it. It was cool. It was a really cool thing. And I just can't, like, nowadays this does not, like, the thing that, like, recommends music for you does not sound groundbreaking. But again, 2000. And he tells me that him and his buddy got offered $1 million from Winamp, this company, for this software. And they turned it down. And I was like, you turned down $1 million? And he's like, well, it's only $500,000 each. And like, you turned down $500,000? And he's like, yeah.
After taxes.
No, like, it just wasn't a good deal. They wanted us to come work for them. We didn't want to work for them.
Yeah.
So kept in touch, you know, lost touch with Adam a little bit through high school, but enough that we kept in touch. And in freshman year, Georgia Tech had a really strict cheating policy about programming homework. It's really easy to, quote, cheat on programming homework because like two people could work on a thing together and then submit very, very similar code. Anyway, so they had, and he was like, if you need help, this was like college students were famous, like Georgia Tech was famous for being overly strict and like failing people out of intro to programming for like having code that was too similar. And so Adam was like, well, if you need any help, message me because you don't want to, you know, accidentally fail this class. So we were talking in the end of like freshman year, sophomore year, I got a co-op at NASA and I said, what are you doing this summer? And he said, I got an internship at this startup. And I said, oh, does it pay well? And he said, no, but they give you stock. And I viscerally, very, very clearly remember thinking like, why that sounds stupid. You should get a paycheck. Who the fuck would want stock in this nothing company?
You've got me on the edge of my seat.
So look, like the end of the story is like, Adam and I kind of fell out of touch at that point. I lost track of what he was doing. I was into my NASA stuff and my car racing and rec racing. But he still worked for this company. You might have heard of it. It was called Facebook. And his internship was being their CTO. And that kid that he wrote the software with in high school was Mark Zuckerberg.
Jeez Louise.
And look, I have no regrets about the way my career has turned out. But had I been more into programming freshman year, I could bet you that I would have gone and worked there with Adam. It's in the realm of possibility, right?
That's awesome.
So yeah, like
that's awesome.
I looked him up years later. I was like, oh, he's in California. I'm going to California on work. I should say hi. And like Googled to like see if I could find him on LinkedIn or something. And then like you follow this trail back and you realize like, oh, whoa. Yeah. I ended up having dinner with him years later, but yeah.
It's so cool. So under that, so that's interesting. I, I'm always looking for little trends, right? So best programmer in the world, true, close to true, whatever. What really stands out for me is I think I've been around a lot of like world-class people. I don't consider myself one of them, but I do have a knack for being pretty lucky to be around. You're one of them. I am definitely not here to blow smoke up your ass. I think there's plenty of others on our team that are one of them. Last week, maybe 2 weeks ago, I interviewed Kevin Schneider on this podcast. He's absolutely one of them. And then I've been around professional athletes so my takeaway there is that it does seem like there's people that seem to like want to be around, like, you know, rise to their surroundings. And then there's other people that want to be the top dog in their surroundings. Right. And I, you know, unsolicited advice for everybody listening. My life has been much, much better by, you know, being uncomfortable, being around people all smarter than me. Yeah, I don't know what my takeaway is for that, but it made me think, you're one of the smarter people I've met in my life, and it's been a fun journey for the last year that I've been here. So I think that's a good end of that thought. I'll Thanks. Let you share whatever you want. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I don't feel like I'm all that smart. I do have some unique talents, but one of them is just not giving a crap at how much higher above me somebody is when I'm with them. Mm-hmm. And there's a certain, like you said, a certain quality of person where they know how good they are, but they appreciate it when they're not being like adored and just agreed with because of their level in the industry. So I seem to be too dumb to know when I'm supposed to give somebody reverence and deference. And then I sort of find my way around to people who can tolerate that level of idiocy.
That might actually be, if I was giving myself credit for something, that might be one of my reasons I do find myself around what I would call like world-class people, is I see most people as just people. I spent some time around like Michael Jordan one time. It's actually a really funny story, but not appropriate here. But, and I was just like, he's just a dude that can dunk a ball really freaking good. He's done a good job of monetizing it. And I do think that brings like a comfort and relatability or something. So, to end the life and career story kind of section, let's talk a little bit about your role at Toolpath and specifically about how it's evolved. Maybe we can talk a little bit about kind of what you fear, you know, from either Toolpath in the industry, your role, or, you know, however you want to take that. And then let's end it with, I like to end on a like positive sandwich, right? Like good, bad, good. Let's end it with like, what do you look forward to at Toolpath or industry, however you want. So there's kind of three points to that.
Early on in Toolpath, I was a developer, still like to think of myself as a developer, but Faye and I were working on the core engine stuff. And Brad, who's another one of our developers, is working on the front end. I had built some websites in my life, but nothing recent or modern and nothing good. That was a year and a half, maybe, as the team grew a little bit more and a little bit more. I evolved into more of an engineering manager role, where I had to balance the needs of who we hired into what team and how we coordinated between the teams. I was okay at that role in the beginning. As the team grew more and as our challenges shifted further and further away from like really hard AI CAM problems and more toward like really hard user interface design and web development problems, I was not the leader that this company needed. And so more recently we hired an engineering director. And I think most people would say about me, have said to my face, that I have a control problem and I don't like to let other people make decisions. And there's a lot of truth to that. But I was, excited to find out that once we got somebody who could clearly handle the job and like very obviously was better than me at it, and motivated by it. I sort of had no trouble handing it off to Paul Evans. One fun side story that I bet you haven't heard. Right after he accepted the job, but before he officially started, he wanted to come make some parts. And he had watched some Machinist YouTube. But like that was like the last gate, right? Let's get you to the shop and have you make some parts. And we were doing something. And the moment I really knew that he was going to be fine here, we had made, I don't even remember what it was, but we had made a part. And I had walked him through most of it, had him press some buttons on the control. But it's a typical first-time CNC thing. He's really just pressing the buttons. And then I wanted to show him some of the deficiencies in the software and stuff. And so I was like, okay, I was going to mount the RegoFix manual pump. I'm going to mount it on the wall to get it off the workbench. This was like a shop chore, a little lean improvement I wanted to do. So I said, let's cat up this bracket. I went to the scrap bin and pulled out a couple of chunks of aluminum. And literally all I wanted to do was like put four holes and two counterbores in this thing. That was it. Like nothing else, right? And I was like, let's have Toolpath do this. And this was, you know, I don't know, 4 or 5 months ago now, something like that. When doing something that simple, like Toolpath was better at machining an entire part, but like telling it not to profile and face and to get it to choose the drills you want, it was harder. It's unfortunately still a little harder than it should be right now, but I know that we're working actively on that. And so he watched, like, we struggled through it. We got it to work. And then I'm like, cool, but I got to hold this thing in the vise and these offcuts have like horrible bandsaw cuts on them. So I threw a face mill in the mill and I chucked it up in the vise and I was like, I'm not even going to program this. I'm just going to hand wheel jog and like take 20 thou off the top or something. And he like pushed me out of the way. He was like, let me do that. And not in like a dangerous way or anything, but kicked me off the damn mill. He was like, let me do this part. And I was
like, great.
Oh, you're going to be fine. This is the place for you. You know,
I think we've got a winner. That's awesome. How much of your roles at Toolpath, I don't think the titles matter that much, right? I mean, you've been the CTO, but how much of your roles have felt like new and challenging to you and like just you personally and all that?
Well, I mean, during the early days,
it's a bit too personal, just push back. Yeah.
Running the Toolpath machine shop out of my garage was completely out of my element. I mean, we were just taking bullshit jobs off Xometry, making no money off of them, but that wasn't the point. To make money. I don't want to say I was uncomfortable because I don't really, I mean, other than like feeling like this machine could kill me and I have no idea how to use it, but still somehow being excited to press the buttons. I like that whole experience of like making parts, having them not come out right, having to order more stock. I made Sharon go to McMaster like 4 times one day to get more stock over and over and over.
Just so everybody knows, how close is McMaster to you, Justin?
15 minutes. I can will call.
Nobody likes a bragger. Nobody likes a bragger. So move on. That's pretty awesome. I just taught someone about McMaster for the first time after they got their second wrong order from Amazon, some garbage gas shock things.
Right.
And I was like, oh, we can order a McMaster and it'll be right. I can get a CAD model. And we can have it by 1 o'clock. I'm in Sacramento, California, so it's coming from Southern California. But like, we'll have it by 1 o'clock tomorrow. And he's like, no way. And I'm like, or you could just order it for a third time or fourth time from Amazon. And he's like, shit, okay. And then you have it 15 minutes for me to go pick up Will Call. That's awesome.
I like to ride my bike to McMaster sometimes, never under a deadline for machining, but like when I needed bolts or whatever. One time I was buying some tubing to fabricate something. And I rode my bike to McMaster and I picked up a 6-foot-long like cardboard tube and I strapped it to my back, like into my camelback, like a freaking ninja sword. So I walk into Will Call like with my helmet in my spandex and I'm like, I need this thing. And they hand me this sword. And then because it's in the air conditioning, I like strap it to my back like a ninja sword in my spandex in the McMaster Will Call thing. And then walk outside, get on my bike, and ride 15 miles home.
I'm certain you can find that security footage on YouTube somewhere. That's awesome. All right, wrapping up career stuff. You are getting ready to take a sabbatical, right? To me, that's really interesting. It's honestly, I was going to say a relief. It's not a relief.
You can be honest.
That sounds different than what I wanted it to sound. I felt so I've been working a lot in the shadows since I broke my neck at Toolpath, a lot of late at night and stuff. So I haven't been one-on-one with as many people as I would like, but you have put in an insane amount of work from the time I've been here, and I know it went way past that. So, I wrote down control, and I actually have similar something in my soul, like when it comes to like machining stuff. Like I just want to help. I don't feel like it's control. I just want to help everybody do it right. And so to me, that's a huge step for you. Is it, you okay talking about, so you're taking some time off, you're doing some, I think some pretty cool stuff. Talk about this as much as you want, to share, but really specifically what I'm thinking is I feel like it's a big sign of how much you trust the team that we've built. And we've already kind of talked on this last couple hours about how kind of proud I am of the team that we've, you know, put around us. I'll stop talking and leave that for you to share.
So this is not meant to brag, but I do want to put some context in here. I've taken one vacation in my time at Toolpath. I went to ride my bike at Moab for 4 days, my mountain bike. That's not true. I did one other vacation where I went to bike up Mount Mitchell. That's the hardest bike ride I've ever done in my entire life. Almost killed me. So two vacations. The Mount Mitchell one, though, was like over a weekend, so I only took one day off. That's like over 4.5 years, right? And then while I was doing full-time NASA, full-time Toolpath, 100-hour weeks are regular for me. Because I love it. I love what I do.
Sorry to interrupt. I know a lot of people that say that. I know you're one of the ones that I'm glad you're not keeping track of the time.
I've said before, recently, actually, on a podcast with Dylan and Zap, I am like pathologically attracted to the hardest problem in front of me, like that I can imagine. I don't think people appreciate the depth of what I mean when I say that. I mean, like the problems that people tell me are impossible and that everybody believes are impossible and that I think are probably also impossible, I'm going to go after it anyway, right? Like, And maybe it takes a level of arrogance to go after that, but I'm just not happy unless I'm doing that. It's just the way my brain is wired. And unfortunately for my son, it's the way his brain is wired. So he will also have to grow up and learn that not everybody works that way. And some people are happy to take a weekend off or whatever. It doesn't work that way for me. But there are a few life events that have happened. I haven't shared a lot about this publicly, but like in the middle of IMTS, like the biggest moment and that point for Toolpath, we're spending hundreds of thousands of dollars. This is our coming out party. You've just joined the company. Al's just joined the company. We're about to enter this whole new phase. It feels like the entire weight of the world is on this event. It has to go right. It has to go right. And like 2 days into it, my dad has like a pretty major health scare to the point that I was about to walk out of IMTS and go sit with my dad. I ended up not doing that. I bought like 3 plane tickets, like one for each day, just being like, I just bought them. And if I didn't go. Right after that happened, I was like, you know, I probably should spend some more time with my dad. And I haven't managed to do that other than to go, take care of him a little bit. And even those times I worked, I don't think most people on the team would have known that I wasn't at home. So, I think, you know, I don't like to admit that I'm burnt out, but I think, you know, controlling my quickness to be frustrated and my ability to contribute collectively to a team of people that are frankly far more capable than I am in a lot of areas of what we're doing now. And I need a little bit of time to recharge my batteries. So I'm going to take some time off. For the first time, I'm going to actively just choose to not work on Toolpath stuff for a long time. But yeah, like you said, I can only do that because everybody around me is got it handled. Yeah,
I think that's pretty relatable. Thinking about our audience, right? We have a lot of smaller shops, mid-sized shops, a lot of shops that are dependent on the shop owners. I feel like most of my friends outside of Toolpath are shop owners. And I've had my own business. I didn't own a shop, but I did, contract work where like 100-hour weeks were very common. I remember, I don't want to get too personal. I remember when you walked up to me and told me about your dad, I have a pretty crappy memory. I've bounced my head off the ground a couple times. But I feel like one of the things I'll remember for most of my life, at least, is the look in your eyes when that happened. And I saw you kind of go through that week of, excitement, and I imagine pretty low lows. So I'm very happy to hear that you're taking time to spend with your dad. I know some of the other side stuff you're doing that I'm also excited to hear about. But I would hope that everybody listening to this, like, find time to invest in your team so you can trust your team. Find a way to spend with your family and loved ones and all that. Cause I almost died recently, and I've probably become more, connected to how much time we spend with each other. So I'm glad you're taking some personal time. Now let's focus forward. This is one of the things I write when I used to race. I don't think I'll ever be a racer again, or at least not on a dirt bike. But
only for RC cars.
RC cars, that's my new thing. It doesn't scratch the same itch, but it scratches many of the itches that I had. So I used to, at the end of all my races, I would write focus forward. Like, what do I need to do to focus forward? So let's just have fun with this. If you're going to start a machine shop tomorrow, what kind of shop would it be? What kind of market would you target? What machines would you pick? I hope I can answer one of the softwares you would choose. Just talk about that. Like, so this is a really interesting perspective for hopefully a lot of the people listening. You have a pretty interesting perspective of our industry, we all do, but I think you specifically do. And I think in the time that I've been here, you've also invested a good amount of your time, very genuinely trying to more just deeply, authentically, understand our customers' challenges.
My internships.
Yeah. Your little internships. So little, I say little, like, so I rambled enough. I think you understand the question. Share. Let's see what kind of comes from this.
If I was starting a shop tomorrow, I'd be a little conflicted. If you're just in it for the money, then figure out how to get ITAR certified, CMMC. There is a huge need right now for shops that can do classified work, military stuff, and you'll make incredible money doing it. It is a huge pain in the ass. You'll spend almost as much time doing paperwork as you do machining parts. And you'll have to become a big shop quickly. All kinds of weird stories that I've heard from people who have done that. But like, if you're just, if your goal is to be a machinist and make a really, really lot of money, especially if you're asking yourself, like, I'm going to buy this machine and where do I find customers? If you don't even know where to start there, then I would say start at CMMC and ITAR. And I say that knowing that Toolpath is not currently ITAR capable. It is on our roadmap. We are going to do it. But like, so if it's a pure money play, like, that's where the money is. It's weird though. You won't be able to talk about what you make. You have to be really careful. Like, literally, you can't tell anything about what you do to your family. It can be really tough. I've worked on a few classified projects. It's weird.
So have I, and it is weird. Yeah.
But that's where I would go. I would, if I was starting out, me personally, I would not go after the big customers like a SpaceX or a Blue Origin. It's too risky. It's too risky as a small shop. Too risky in the sense that they could reject your parts, or they could take your parts and not pay you, or not pay you for 6 months and then pay you. It's just, it's really challenging. If you depend on that revenue, I would say find other customers first. Be big enough that you can afford the risk. And get, it's called accounts receivable insurance. Get that too, if you're going to go after those customers.
That's a good nugget right there.
Right.
I haven't heard about or thought about that in a lot of years. I'm glad you brought that up. Worth the episode right there.
Yeah.
All right, keep going. Don't let me interrupt.
What kind of machines would I buy? I would struggle to buy anything other than a 5-axis right now. It's a little bit weird because to be a really efficient shop, it seems like you actually need a 5-axis and a 3-axis. But if you only had to have one, it would be a 5-axis. There's a lot of different options you could go with, you know, Haas or Hermley or Kern or DN Solutions. There's a million. Okuma, there's a million options. And the specific one you buy depends so much on your personal financial situation and stuff. I would love to imagine that I could be a great product guy and that I would start a shop and build a product, but I would be a terrible product guy. I don't enjoy the iterative process of refinement. I'm not good at, like, everything I'm making in CAD is like blocks, you know, scripts. I can use the fillet button.
Overuse the fillet button?
But, you know, I would enjoy, like, iteratively refining a production process, but not for my own product. That would stress me out too much. So I might, like, work with somebody on that. Man, I have to admit, like, except for the crazy huge amounts of travel, being like a contract application engineer would scratch my itch of always solving somebody else's really hard problem. I don't think I'd enjoy that lifestyle very much. The right answer, I think, might be like a B-axis dual spindle lathe. Such efficient production. It's the easy button for automation. I will actually go into automation, and I work for Toolpath, so very obviously, but I would figure out how to invest in automation right from the start. Spindle gripping is where I would start. I would get good at spindle gripping. Cobot, whatever. If you're more comfortable buying an integrated solution, you know, buy from that. But just like, I don't know how I could be competitive, even if you're only making like 5 of something, just not having to be glued to the machine. So that's like my one thing, is that whatever I start would have to, and I say that having no automation in our shop right now, but wanting it dearly for when we have to make swag. So, you know, I think that, you know, obviously very self-serving, but Toolpath is trying to make it so that one person can run 5 mills. But that only works with automation. So, you know, if money was no object, I'd have a fancy 5-axis and a dual spindle, you know, dual spindle B-axis lathe, and a 3-axis machine. Those would be, you know, my weapons of choice. I don't think I would do the Swiss thing just because I would lean too far away from production. They're cool machines. I'd love to learn how to run one. They're weird though. So I don't know. Not my jam, I guess.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. So the ITAR CMCC you brought up, you mentioned it's on our roadmap. I'm trying to think through how to somewhat smartly ask a follow-up question to that. So, I mean, everybody wants to know when. I think the question I'm trying to shape more is like, what would be the thing that triggers us to like invest in that, make it happen?
So here's the deal.
Give a little more detail on it.
Toolpath is a CAM automation company. And that's weird. If you look at the product we brought to market at ITAR, it was an estimating product. We never stopped being a CAM automation company, but it's really hard to automate CAM well, really, really hard. And on the path to that, we had tech that would allow you to estimate. And also having run parts for Xometry, I felt like that was also a very strong need. Underappreciated by a lot of the industry folks who don't have to quote all the time. But the job shop guys like need help. And I thought we had tech that could do that. So we went after that market. But our goal was always to automate CAM, and we've never really wavered from starting with Fusion and really attacking that market. Fusion is not ITAR. And despite what Autodesk says, I'm not sure it'll ever be ITAR. Seems like a huge missed opportunity for them, and I cannot for the life of me understand the decision being made there, but, you know, it's far out on the roadmap. It's coming, right? So why would we go ITAR if Fusion's not ITAR? Well, there's lots of shops that would get a lot of benefit out of our estimating software, which is getting better and better as we get better at programming, whether they're using Fusion or not, right? It could be a Mastercam or a Hypermill shop and still get a lot of value out of an estimating product. But also, we will not be tied to Fusion forever. We have partnership with ModuleWorks. We We've talked to folks at like SolidCam and MasterCam, Hypermill. We will support those other CAM systems. And there are lots of shops out there that even if they don't need ITAR, it's like, well, I don't want to invest in a system that would exclude me from ITAR in the future. And so I think that that's an important thing. Like even if all of our customers right now are all Fusion and they don't care about ITAR on their daily basis, asking them to build a system around an automation system that, frankly, they would become quickly dependent on. Hopefully a good reason, right? Because that's the only way they could be efficient enough to run 5 mils. It's just a functionality we have to have. So, I'll put a stake in the ground and say that in 2026, we'll put out an ITAR product. I think that's reasonable and we can achieve it.
Great.
We have been designing to support ITAR. We just haven't sort of implemented on an ITAR-friendly platform. And maybe if I had to go back in time, we would have just started there because it wouldn't have been that much harder. But our thinking was, why incur extra challenges when Fusion is an ITAR anyway? But
yeah, I think the most encouraging thing to me, just knowing more of the insider info, is that honestly, the insider info on more than just Toolpath. But is that I think before I started at Toolpath, or maybe I was dumb enough to wait until just after I started, but I remember asking like, hey, what have we done for this? Are we architecting ourselves into a corner to not be able to pivot in that direction? And, I guess I could just go on blind faith and trust that you understood the problem. Was Paul Evans involved in that?
He's involved in scoping it out. Yeah. So he'll be the one to actually implement and execute that. I knew enough about what I was doing to make sure we weren't doing anything that would prevent us from, like, basically there's a series of technologies in Amazon's cloud stack that you can rely on for being ITAR compliant and some that you can't.
Yeah.
And I was just careful to make sure I didn't choose anything that we couldn't rely on.
My brother, I don't need to go too far down that rabbit hole. My brother works at the Pentagon. He specializes in tech stuff. And when he first heard I was at Autodesk working on Fusion, and I was selling the genius of Fusion, he literally was like, he Googled it, looked it up, and then he texted me back, F you in the cloud. And I was like, oh. And then it was fairly shortly after that, he was like, oh, I actually think you guys have a path with GovCloud through Amazon, all this stuff. We don't need to go too far down that. But my hope is that I share similar concerns about Fusion. I think it's a decision in resources. I think they may have painted themselves into some corners there. But if they decide, they can. So I'm glad that we haven't painted ourselves in a corner. So I think we've belabored that enough. Next question is, what's one thing software companies still misunderstand about machinists and how shops actually work?
I would say, like, from my sort of limited time as a machinist, I call myself a baby machinist. I would say they misunderstand the weird dichotomy of how important the software is to their business and how it doesn't matter at all. All at the same time. Like, if you invest a lot of time in a CAM system and you get a really dialed process and you can't, I mean, most people can't run their machines. You got a lot of surfacing. You literally cannot make your parts without that CAM system. And also, it is like the smallest part of what making good parts comes out to be, right? Like, and both of those things are true all at the same time. And it's really odd. But if I had to boil that down into something a little bit more concrete, I would say, software people do not understand how scary it is to press the green button. They just don't.
Yeah, they just don't.
The closest that some software engineers could come to it is like if you're working at Facebook and you have to, or whatever, a big Google, and you have to deploy software that could like brick everybody's everything. But the difference is that software engineers, for the most part, have tests that tell them it's going to be okay. And when those tests pass, not always, there are outages, there are whoopsies, right? But for the most part, those tests tell you it's going to be okay. You can hit the deploy button and walk away. Because of how like backwards CNC machines really are, like, you could have a full sim and the sim could say everything is fine and it's still not okay, right? Like the tool could not match the sim or set the wrong work coordinate system. And so I think like the importance of like understanding that there are limits to what your software can do. And then the other thing is that, and I don't believe we've achieved this yet, to be fair and honest, but I like to say that Toolpath should not tell you, Tim Paul, the machinist, how to program. You should tell it how to program. I don't believe that we've achieved that yet. We give you some control, the bare minimum, I think that would be acceptable for our product. I hope to add a lot more control in there. I don't think software engineers, if you haven't spent time on a machine, understand why that's important. There are a lot of really bad ways and really wrong ways to make a part. And then there's a lot of ways to make a part, and they're all equally almost correct. And so like the reason machinists are so particular is that they have a process and it works. And if they follow that process, they won't break their spindle. They won't scrap their $80,000 one-off piece of customer provided stock. They won't ruin their business. They like all of these things. And so if you go to them and you're like, oh, like you don't have to face your part with a face mill, just use an end mill. Like if their process involves always facing their stock, then like, screw you. And it doesn't matter whether I'm right or wrong. Like it's not their process. They can't use it. And I can appreciate that. And look, there has to be some amount of flexibility to adopt automation. Yeah. We're never going to make it exactly the way you, Tim Paul, would program a part, but it has to be close enough. It has to be close enough that you can get comfortable running the part. If we can't do that and provide you that like slow path to change, because as you adopt automation, you start getting comfortable with maybe different strategies or, you know, maybe the program's not as efficient as you would have made it, but doesn't matter because it's on the machine and it's running and it's not a production job. So you're on to the next thing. But we have to provide people a slow path to do that because we can't destroy their $1 million worth of capital equipment that they can't replace. Just the way it is.
Yeah. And anybody listening, you know, that $80,000 this, the $1 million that's all relative, right? So that's $1,000 to one person and $1 million to another person. I've been running parts out of Toolpath basically with a quick simulation and going out to my machine. My machine's my damn hobby. And so when I think about wadding up a $10,000 spindle, it feels like $1 million to me, right? And for how lean some of these job shops are, you know, I mean, just throwing away a $1,000, $10,000, what, you know, a several hundred dollar tool, it all means something different. It's something that could literally screw up their whole month, screw up their whole year. It's some people we talk to, you know, screw up their whole business. So it's good for me to hear that. What I'll say, I didn't, it was a question for you, but I like to add my own. I spent a lot of time at Autodesk, working with the executives, trying to just really help them understand the mental perspective of a machine shop. And I had said a couple times, like, don't underestimate the stress that happens in these machines. We make software that drives machines that can literally kill people. And one of my favorite executives was like, that sounds pretty hyperbolic, Tim. And this is me tying it all back together to early in our conversation when we're talking about throwing stuff out of machines, right? I don't need to rehash stories, but I've been around, I've seen, I've had late night texts where friends were telling me they literally pooped their pants. And so what's very encouraging to me, and I'll compliment you and Andy, the other co-founder. When I was interviewing for this job, something that I remember, it gave me goosebumps. I feel like both of you said, you and Andy both agreed early when you were kind of scoping out this concept and idea. It was like, we have to respect the complexity of the problem. And literally the first thing I thought about was having this executive in a meeting tell me I was being hyperbolic about, you know, talking about a machine that could kill someone. And I know I don't want to minimize the risk or exaggerate it, but it is a real risk. So you know, the other thing I think the software companies misunderstand is the respect of the process that works, right? I think a lot of software companies like, you know, why wouldn't you change? It's the future. It's the best. It's the whatever. And it's like, you have a dynamic of a lot of our industry, like they deserve to use what they're using until they retire. It's 2 years from now, right? And then the others of just like, it's a process, it's profitable, it works. And it's been really encouraging for me to be at Toolpath and understand we're trying to find that balance. What were you going to say before I cut you off?
You inadvertently gave me, you didn't teach me, but you gave me the opportunity to understand that reality for me more deeply.
Good. When you're making a difference.
When you first joined Toolpath, my dad is a surgeon, a foot and ankle surgeon. And you had a pretty bad foot and ankle injury, two foot and ankle injuries.
Two foot and ankle injuries.
And you said, yeah, send my x-rays to my dad, to your dad,
that's right.
And see what he said. And I had just listened to an episode of With Intolerance. It's a very, very, very specific memory with Mickey Jacobs and Alex Kern. And they were joking about how Mickey, like, very commonly will walk up to somebody and be like, that's not how I would do it, right? And like, he doesn't mean to be discouraging, or it's just not how he would do it. I sent the x-rays to my dad, and I kid you not, like 15 seconds later, I got a text back saying, that's not how I would have done it. You know, and it was like the angle of the screws he didn't like or something. And you had a great surgeon. And all that matters is that you had a good outcome where you could, you know, walk again and have good range of motion. But when he said that, it like was the timing of it was so close to when Mickey Jacobs, that's not how I would do it. I was like, oh, machinists are just surgeons. And so I think what software people miss is that, like, if you were writing software for a Da Vinci robot for cancer, like you, that cannot break. Right. And you have to think about, okay, like, all right, if it goes down, how does a surgeon step in? And like, somebody's life is on the line. And so nobody is really going to question you if you're like, look, this has to work 100%. This cannot fail. And maybe it's a tad hyperbolic, but only a tad. Machinists feel that way about their machines and the parts they make, right? It's not life or death if you scrap a part, but it could be your livelihood, or it could be somebody's rocket blows up, or the airplane crashes. Or their gun doesn't work. You know, or like you scrap $100,000 mold to make injection molds for, you know, like it matters a lot. It matters a lot. And I know you've been involved in like accident investigations and stuff. So like, I think the level of sort of care and understanding of the process and like respecting the process, there are surgeons who won't do the newest thing, even if they have 10 years left in their career, because they have 20 years of it working well for them. And they're like, well, I could try this new thing and maybe it'll work, but I know this will work. So if you want the new thing, go find some guy who knows how to do the new thing, right? Like machinists feel the same way about their process. And sometimes some of them are willing to learn and evolve. And sometimes a new process is so good that you have to adopt it. It's like inarguable, right? Like five axis is one of those. I think zero point work holding falls into that category. But
Cam was that category when I started.
Yeah. Cam.
I've been 25 years as of this year, I think. And it's been so exciting for me to see this evolution. And then I also was taught by people, so I feel like I kind of had some of their evolution, and it's been a fun ride. And I came to Toolpath because I do feel like we are the next, should be, you know, it's ours to screw up, I think, you know, the next big, you know, shift for productivity. So, my next question is about AI. So let's start off with the question I get asked fairly often. What the hell is AI, Justin? And then I'll follow it up with my AI question.
Fun fact, AI is older than CNC machining. The very first technical paper on AI was published in like 48 or 49, I think. And the very first NC stuff was in 52. To be frank, AI is a big giant pile of math that we understand the basics of math, but modern AI, they literally do not know how it works. Like ChatGPT and LLMs and all of that stuff, they do not know. Anyway, setting that aside, essentially, AI is any form of sort of computer program that can generalize from the things you told it to the things you didn't tell it. So, you know, we don't teach Toolpath how to program every part in the world. Believe it or not, we only train Toolpath on like 30 parts. And yet it's pretty good at programming most parts you throw at it. Not every part, but many parts. So that is what I think, you know, that's machine learning has really been renamed to AI. There's kind of a progression or a spectrum there. But what sets that field apart is like, there's some mathematical models that can only interpolate, so they can be fairly accurate between data that they've seen. So in the machining world, that would be like, you know, if you have a family of parts that are all very, very similar, and you somehow came up with like a super template that could program any of those parts really well, we wouldn't call that, like, in the strictest terms, we wouldn't call that AI. We would call that like interpolation or regression. But then if you can make a model that you can give it some data points and then go far outside or even a little bit outside those data points. And so again, in a machining term, that would be like, you know, I wrote a program and I trained it on how to machine this shape, you know, this clamp thing here. And then I asked it to machine this other thing that doesn't, is bicycle part, doesn't look anything like that. And if it could do a decent job on this, based on what I told it about that, then that's AI. It's the ability to generalize outside its training data set that makes, that distinguishes sort of like basic modeling and regression from AI.
Hopefully you just bought the Uniforce clamp instead of made it yourself.
I think Ben bought this one, but yeah.
Yeah, just kidding. Okay, so that's a good lead in to where do you think AI will create the biggest change for manufacturing in the next whatever years, 5 years, 3 years, 10?
It's not AI by itself, but AI plus automation. And I'm going to use automation in the broadest sense. I'm going to include like 3+2, 5-axis machines, right? As their price continues to come down and they get more affordable, part loading and pallet loading, robotic loading systems, bar feed, high product, all of that stuff. I'm calling all of that automation, which is a gross generalization, but that combined with CAM automation will make it. So I think like the lower end of the skill level on this job market will have trouble. The operator job where you're literally just pushing a button I think that'll go away. And maybe that's not great, you know, economy wise. We've seen automation do that in other areas of manufacturing and it causes churn, but if manufacturing is ever going to be competitive in the United States ever again, we have no choice but to move into that field. So those sort of entry level jobs will go away. Which causes an interesting effect. There's a lot of people in this industry that progress from operator to, you know, machinist to setup machinist to programmer to job shop owner. So we as an industry have to be careful to not turn machining into this like high barrier of entry job that you like have to go get like a college degree in automation to run a shop. Because that's also not viable, because the people who enjoy machining don't typically go through that kind of education. And the way we've structured our education system, you know, won't support that. You don't want to have to go to college and take calculus classes to be a machinist. That's not appropriate. So I think that's an industry thing that we will, as an industry, have to figure out. Like, the training pipeline will have to evolve to get people in.
Yeah, the good news is we haven't evolved it in a long damn time, so it's ripe and ready to be evolved. What I'll add, just from my perspective, is I know shops that have done a really good job of automating a lot of their shops. Those shops have not been laying people off. They take someone that was, you know, an entry level, basically parts changer, to now they're trying to keep up with these pallets of parts. Now they're dealing with, you know, making sure the right material is ready to go on the pallet system. Right. A lot of them have transitioned into being, quality inspector, you know, inspection people. And my big encouragement to anybody who's listening that's worried about any of these, you know, job loss type situations is, anybody in your circle of influence, let's all do a better job at encouraging people to do whatever it takes to make more awesome parts. I know a lot of people that are like, nope, I'm an operator. I don't want to be a programmer, or I'm a programmer. I don't want to blah, blah, blah. I am so far out of my comfort zone most of my career, and it's taken me to so many awesome places. And every shop owner I know that's kind of embraced that, like, I just own all the problems. And every machine shop person I know that's kind of just, yeah, I'm a machinist. I do whatever it takes to make parts. Those shops and people are the people that thrive in this industry. So my hope when it comes to education is that we can get young people, you know, I think it starts in 6th, 7th, 8th grade, to start remembering how it is to make a birdhouse. So because that like triggers something in someone's brain. Like, man, I took a pile of nothing and turned it into a pile of something. And we can kind of help start teaching people how to be problem solvers and thinkers and not just, you know, follow these set of instructions. So I can actually go for a lot longer on that, and I shouldn't. So any final thoughts before we move on to the next one?
I think Al said this, that we have to make, you know, 10 times as many parts with 2 times as mm-hmm. many people. I think we'll be lucky to have 2 times as many people. So like you said, the rise of automation will change the industry, and the low skill jobs may go away, but those same people can up level to quality inspectors, or tending, you know, many more machines, or keeping the pallet pool filled. Those, like, we need more of that. So the demand isn't going away. It's a great industry to be a part of. But it will change. It absolutely will change.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I can draw so many parallels to just machining or any other manufacturing. I knew people that used to take 5,000 by 5,000 by 2,000 chips and under robotic not even robotic, but they used to basically place those on the circuits. Mm-hmm. That all got replaced. And they started doing, you know, wire bonding, you know, real similar. They had the security to do tiny, absurdly small things. And there's still places for those people, but let's move on. So as an industry, how do we balance pushing innovation forward while keeping the human at the center of it, right? This is dovetails into what we're talking about. This dovetails into what we were talking about, you know, earlier with like respecting the process and all that too. I think what I'll call out before you answer is I think you have a more natural desire to get over that activation energy. That's a term that I think you taught me, than many, many people in our industry do. But at the same time, like, you don't want to be the hammer where everything's a nail. So let's get some of your thoughts on, like, yeah, how do you balance like pushing forward and embracing innovation? How do you think about it?
I have sort of, and this is a little ironic because software, they do agile development, which actually came from lean in manufacturing. And so I kind of went backwards from agile to discovering lean, and then lean like helping me rediscover agile back in software. But, I would say that you take a lean approach and you look for what are the bottlenecks in your shop and you invest in ways to improve that. Sure, this answer is a little self-serving, but, find me a job shop who doesn't spend too much time quoting, or find me a job shop who couldn't benefit from quoting faster, or just, you know, quoting more. You need like, nobody likes quoting. It's a lot of energy put into work into something that may or may not pay you money. So that like, that feels like an easy place to improve your process, but it's very, very easy to be like, I'm not going to spend the time and energy to get my quoting dialed, whether you use Toolpath or, you know, there's other software out there, like Paperless offers some functionality like that. There's tons, you know, DigiFabster has their own version of it. There's tons of stuff out there that can help you quote. Machine Metrics, I think, has their own stuff. But you don't see the large adoption of that stuff because I don't think people are honest with themselves about how much of a bottleneck that is. And I think the shops that I've seen be successful, granted, there's a little bit of survivor bias in this, but I see them actively looking to improve. And whether they use like a lean approach or not, there's other ways to do it. And so if your bottleneck is runtime and spindle time and not quoting, then, you know, if you're CJ Abraham, I guess, then you invest in automation at the machine level. If you're, if you don't have enough work or you have dry spells, then you should be investing in quoting and not focusing on shop floor stuff, or at least not putting the most of your effort on that. So how do you keep the human at the center of it? I mean, the reality is that large portions or huge portions of this industry are shops of less than 20 people, something like 70% or something.
Huge percentage,
So like the human's at the center, whether you like it or not, and making their job easier so they can be more productive should be all of our goals, whether it's your business or not, you know. But if you're the owner, like it's, you know, and Jay Pearson and Andrew Henry have a great, and the Incremental podcast, Devin Bodoni and Uriel, they all talk about how transformational it is for their business. And sometimes I don't think people listen enough to that. But if you're a business owner of a 20 man shop, like for you, improving that efficiency is really about improving your bottom line. But you do that through making your employees' lives easier by making them more efficient.
So I'll add on to that. So, if you think about, I think a lot of people listen to Jay and like, I know I will never have that much energy, that much enthusiasm, for lean or any of that. Right. I just say, take like incremental steps. I talk about racing a lot because most of my life has been focused on racing. Like I think about if you're looking to improve your lap time, like where's the biggest opportunity? You know, a lot of people are like, oh, you know, my entry speed into turn one, because that's the most exciting part of their lap. Well, very often that's not the place you're going to win or lose, you know, the race. It's like, actually, you spend more time on the straightaway. So how can you increase your straightaway, you know, or decrease your straightaway time? Well, if you actually come out onto the straightaway a little faster, you can, you know, shorten your straightaway time. My point of that is like, look for your biggest opportunities. Where am I losing the biggest amount of time, and where am I kind of rubbing my employees? This is tying it back to humans at the center, right? Where's my employees getting rubbed the most raw? I went and visited, RC car shop Vanquish, out in Sacramento. And I got a tour of that place. I've been meaning to go there for 10 years. I knew they were doing some special stuff, but they had some of the happiest employees I've come across in a long damn time. Things weren't stressed. They just had kind of a relaxed attitude. But it's because, you know, if you look how they think through problems, they're like, this is our biggest problem now. They just kind of incrementally solve and fix that problem. They've got a ton of pallet loading systems. They don't have anybody standing in front of one machine just loading parts, right? They have one person managing a ton of machines. So they're not kind of going through that like part swapping overload. So,
one thing that Uriel mentioned it, I'm pretty sure it's from something in Paul Aker's book. But he was like, whenever you're walking around the shop and you're doing something, like if you're taking steps across the shop or something, just start muttering to yourself, non-value add, non-value add. And it sounds silly, but I started doing it around the shop. And like the act of saying it out loud, even like in software tasks, like when I was doing some deployment task and it was really rough, I would say non-value add while I'm doing it. It makes it feel a lot more acute. So how do you keep the human at the center? Tell them to mutter non-value add every time they're doing something they don't like. Yeah.
I like it. We're getting close to wrapping up. So share long-term vision, your long-term vision for Toolpath, if you can.
My long-term vision comes down to this. I mean, I would love for it to work on more complex processes, mill turns, lathes, multi-process machines, turning, all of that stuff. But at the very top level, like I am waiting for the day that we have a customer who's like running six machines and is like, couldn't do it without Toolpath. Like Toolpath is what got them there. That's what I want to see. That's my goal for Toolpath, is like the first person who's like, I just bought my sixth machine. I'm signing up for another Toolpath subscription on that machine. Couldn't do this without you guys. Like, I want to see that growth, right? From one machine to six. I think to get there, we will. I mean, obviously, we're working on 3+2 right now. I've been doing my darndest to pretend to be a multi-axis machinist. But
not obviously, but we are, and you've been spending a good amount of energy on it. So, yeah, I cut you off awkwardly.
But like, you know, after 3+2, then you start talking about turning and then multi-process machines would be the next frontier. And I would like to see us automating all of that. There will be a day where some parts can be done completely without a human having to program them, and maybe without a human having to touch them. Those will be the easy parts. Those will be the brackets, the, you know, maybe the Uniforce clamps. I actually don't know what kind of tolerance they hold on these, but they don't look like they're super tight tolerance to me.
Yeah.
Cool. And then that'll be saving our time so that we can build more complex parts. And the other thing I live for, the thing I'm waiting for, is the first time somebody shows me a part that could not have been programmed by hand in any like reasonable amount of time, like some super complex part. And we've seen that progression, like in as CAM has come out, parts get more complex, and then fourth axis becomes common and parts get more, and then 3+2 comes out, and multi-process machines, mill turns, turn mills, parts, like engineers are like salivating to make the most unmachinable crap that these machines can somehow magically make. And the first time somebody shows me a part and they're like, yeah, I don't know, there's like a million little features on it, and it just wasn't going to be feasible to do it by hand. And it had to have been AI assisted. That I will be thrilled to see that day.
Yeah, we will be responsible for making parts more complex. That's an interesting perspective. I've said it and kind of forgotten about it, but yeah, just in the time that I've been machining, I've seen parts grossly get more complex with the advent of, not that I've, CAM was around before I started machining, but it was very pop common that people weren't using CAM. They were just hand coding. Mm-hmm. And then live tool lays, because that was like spaceship stuff, you know, and then fourth axis and then five axis, now B axis. It's been a really fun journey. And kind of to our point earlier, like I'm pretty good at designing to my capability, and the more accessible things become, instead of simplifying parts, maybe people just design parts for lighter weight. And
well, I hope we can also close that loop. For the first time, Toolpath is the first technology I've seen that can provide that feedback back to the engineer, like live in real time.
Yeah.
Like if you're at SpaceX or whatever, they might just plop a manufacturing engineer next to you and he's just sitting there watching you CAD things. And he's like, don't do that. Don't do that. Don't do that.
That's not what happens.
Yeah. But yeah. I mean, like someplace that happens, right? But save that, most engineers have no idea. And hopefully Toolpath can provide enough feedback to actually drive that cycle the other way as well. Like some parts will be more complex and couldn't be done without Toolpath. And then so hopefully there'll be other parts that are like unnecessarily complex right now and get backed off because the guy's like, I didn't care about that feature and I wasn't going to pay $50 for it.
So. Yeah. Yeah. That's a good point. For anybody that hasn't been paying attention, we now Toolpath is available for free to hobbyists, and we haven't had any big announcements yet, but we kind of snuck it in for now, but also to education. And that's why I brought it up is, I'm working with some of my old Autodesk education colleagues, and I think some of the biggest, most like lowest hanging fruit opportunities is with engineering teams. I spent a lot of time mentoring, some of the formula teams and stuff. Like, nope, you got a huge quote for that because of these simple features, right? I think we're already doing a really good job of automating that stuff. Okay. So we're about 2.5 hours in. We're going to do kind of a little quick fire, wrap it up. Any fun Easter eggs in Toolpath software?
Besides the banana for scale, I don't have anything to offer. Oh no.
There's the banana is pretty Easter eggy. So don't belittle that.
Well, there's a button for it now.
Like, there's a button. I guess it's not an Easter egg, but there's a button. Banana for scale, play with it. What else were you going to say?
The section view has been added recently. That's pretty useful. I mean, not groundbreaking, but nice to have in there. We support thread milling. If you didn't know that, we have thread mills.
That's a good one.
Believe it or not, Toolpath will choose the right thread mill for you. You don't have to think about it, which is weirdly freeing.
I have not banged on that enough. And I have thread mills and I love me a thread mill. So I will, I need to start breaking that. Okay. I'll call this my positive sandwich. So let's start by something positive. What are a couple of positive surprises from the machining industry that you can think of? Something that kind of stood out as you were learning more about the industry?
I only entered the industry very recently. Very lucky to do so because I seem to have missed the crusty old angry machinist who won't tell you anything phase.
I'm interrupting and I had to kind of half apologize. You did come in at a pretty awesome time. So I'll shut up and keep going.
You know, the Instagram machinist community, the way Autodesk approaches education is very different from really any other company. So like the YouTube out there, like I had everything I needed to figure out how to use this machine, which is like amazing. Right. So that's positive. The willingness of people to share their knowledge with me for absolutely no reason, is amazing. Especially early on during the Toolpath days, you know, now we have a little bit higher profile. So I'm, you know, lucky that at least there's enough name recognition that if I want to talk to somebody, maybe it doesn't seem so ridiculous, but early on it was like, who's this guy who wants to know stuff? So there's that. Folks like Xometry get a lot of hate, and I think rightly so sometimes for treating their partners not great. But at the same time, like that technology and that, like for people starting out, is a pretty huge opportunity. So pleasantly surprised about that. Yeah, I think those would be the two big ones for me.
That's good.
The ability, like the amount of data available for how to run your tooling, was also like, if you just ask the tooling rent vendors, like they'll tell you a good way to run the tooling like that. I'd always heard that like feeds and speeds were black magic and people don't want to share them. Right. And you always wish that stuff was more available and we're working hard to make it more accessible in Toolpath, but it's out there and it's achievable. Mm-hmm. Like the tooling reps will answer your question and they kind of don't care how nobody you are. If they can sell you one tool, they're happy. So.
Yeah, that's a good one. That's a good one. So say some of the happiness for the other end of the happy sandwich. So yeah, I'll add to that. So I'm starting to sound like this 100-year-old machinist guy. I'm only in my 40s, but 25 years ago, if you wanted to cut ink canal or titanium, it was hard to find a tooling rep that would give you something you could depend on. Now it's very easy. Yeah, I love that you called out the community because when I started in the industry, I have mentors that set me up to go crash very expensive machines just to see what I was made of, right? And I see very, very little of that now. I answer an insane amount of questions on Instagram just from people, you know, struggling to make something. And I'm not the only person that does it, so... okay, so get into the meat of the positivity sandwich. What are some of the more disappointing? I try to be a positive person and not focus on negative things, but what are some of the more disappointing things you've found in the machining industry since you started Toolpath?
How frustratingly, maddeningly bad CAM software works sometimes. I just wasn't prepared for software that sometimes like crashes left and right. Gives like insane tool paths that make no sense, that have like arcane settings everywhere. That mean I just like, I'm pretty good at using software. And I honestly, until you started helping me get my mind wrapped around the 3D tool paths in Fusion, like I didn't feel very good at it. Now I'd say I'm like barely acceptable at it, but I'm not afraid of it anymore. And so that, you know, even with the wealth of information out there, the jump from 2D toolpaths to 3D toolpaths and how to really be effective with them, and also just like how long they can take to run and how finicky they can be sometimes, really caught me off guard. Like I was surprised by that.
Yeah, that's a good one. I too am. I having been a part of Autodesk, I still have a ton of tolerance for it. But I maybe picked up some empathy knowing the people that are trying to solve the problems. And I hope, I mean, you've realized, you know, a lot of the problems we're solving are pretty complex, hairy problems. Yeah, so let's move from the negative side of the sandwich
I've
to
got two more for you.
Go.
I got two
Yeah,
more
go.
For you.
Let's bring it.
There are far too many options for everything that you want to do in machining these days. Like infinite options. You want a three flute end mill?
Yeah.
Infinite.
Infinite.
You want a 0-point work holding system? Infinite. You want a fixed jaw 6-inch vise? There are 17 choices. Which is great. Like competition is great. I'm not upset about the competition, but it's like almost paralyzing when it's like if you're trying to tool up a new machine. And like I'm lucky enough to have great advisors and be in a VC funded company that if I want to, I can afford the best of everything. And it's still hard for me to decide if I'm tooling up a new machine, should I go shrink fit or power grip, right? Like it's a mess.
We've had some of those conversations. Yeah.
And so like it's good and bad all at the same time, but it's really frustrating if you're, it can make it hard to make decisions. And sometimes we need to make decisions faster than that and just be afraid to and be okay with making the wrong one and containing the risk of that situation. But I find that, you know, super frustrating sometimes.
It's a really good call out. You and I are building, we want to have like a similar tool libraries, at the shop and at my house. And, I am very good at picking out tools, and we were just kind of living through some of that frustration still, right? What was the other one?
The last one I'll say is how incredibly difficult it is to give people your money in this industry. It's insane. Yeah. If I want to buy an end mill or order a vise or buy a machine, how hard it can be to do that. And mm-hmm. we're trying, obviously, a toolpath to make it as easy as possible to take your money. But, like, literally sometimes I find myself screaming, shut up and take my money. And it's just wild. I don't understand how this industry can survive if we don't fix that. But it seems to. So there's something.
Do you know any of the dynamics? I have a short version I can share.
No, go ahead. Yeah.
Oh, I mean, the short version is if you're... if you are Kurt Weiss, let's just keep all the names out of it. But if you're a Weiss company and an end mill company and you want to sell to Tim and Justin online, you piss off the local, tooling rep, the tooling distributor,
right.
Not rep, distributor. And that local tooling distributor is a sole source supplier to, let's just say, Boeing, right? And, the local tooling company, will stop selling your X brand end mills or vices if you start selling direct, and they make 80% of their money from Boeing and whoever else. And there's a path to kind of get past that. There's some, you know, a lot of this is just legacy stuff because it's worked this way. We're going to keep going this way, but there's some younger, more dynamic companies that I think will start to kind of break through those barriers, and hopefully, you know, we can make life easy for everybody too. That's the short version. It's bull crap, but all right. Let's end on the positivity sandwich with the other end. What's some of the more hopeful things you've seen in the industry since you've started Toolpath?
Machines and tooling have never been more capable, like ever. My $40,000 style is nearly as good, at least in terms of accuracy, maybe not material removal, as the $100,000 brother. $100,000 brother can keep pace with $1 million Kern on some parts. There are limits, but like you got to go pretty far before you have to have a Kern. That is unbelievable, right? Like the quality of machine you can get for, I don't want to say no money because that's not realistic, but for like affordable money. And then the same with tooling. Like really, there's no reason that you should ever tap in an end mill ever again, ever. Somebody's going to say, well, if it's all I got, sure, if you're bootstrapping and it's all you got, but you should, if you're a successful shop, be able to pretty quickly invest in a couple of good tool holders even if it's just for those small tools.
Yep. Yep. It's a good one. That's a good one.
I would say, you know, if you want to be a machinist, you have it within your capability to be a hero machinist, to make
jewelry.
There's
no better time. Yeah. There's no better time. I've mentored a lot of machinists, and some of them I've kind of lost track, like when their journey started and where they're at now. And I have a hard time saying anybody's better than me, but a lot of people I've mentored have become more accomplished machinists than me. And it's been really fun to watch, kind of to your point, the accessibility, right? The accessibility of knowledge, the accessibility of good tools, the accessibility of good machines, you know, all that has been very encouraging to me. And then it's also encouraging, I'll end on the positive. It's also encouraging that to see like our school systems starting to get more interested in doing something. And I see specific teachers pouring their heart and soul into programs, and hopefully they become kind of beacons for the rest of our education system. So wrap up. So we're in the wrap up callbacks. So, this has been fun for me, Justin. I hope you've enjoyed it.
Yeah, great time.
Snowflakes and rainbows. That's what I got written down here. And I felt like that was a good tagline, and I forgot what my sub bullet from that was, but you said every shop's a snowflake. Talk about that. Like, I think that's a really interesting perspective that's shaped a lot of what we do at Toolpath.
I've been really lucky to be invited to visit a lot of shops, do my internships, and I've still only seen a tiny slice of the industry.
Yeah.
But also through Instagram, every shop has a different customer profile, turnaround time, access to material, right? Like, if I was starting a shop today, my competitive edge would be that I'm 15 minutes from McMaster. Like, I could almost offer same day parts.
Bastard.
Yeah. Right? Like, so, you know, access to tooling, the type of machine you have, the way you like to machine parts, your comfort with different materials, it all combines, like, you know, how invested you are in lean, whether you're a one-man shop or a three-man shop. It all combines to really give every shop a unique fingerprint or a snowflake.
Yeah.
And I could walk into five shops that have, you know, Hermleys and Fifth Axis Vices or HWR, and they would all still make their parts differently and have different processes. And I could show them the same program, and each one of them would say, that's not how I would do it. And they'd say it even if I was showing them their own freaking program from a year ago. It's just like, the only generalization is that there is no generalization, right? Like, I mean, you can make a few, everybody's a hero in aluminum, you know, good tooling.
Not true, but yeah.
good tooling makes good parts easier. Yep. Like, you can see that people who invest in the good stuff are doing better than the guys who are trying to grab grandpa's rusty old high-speed steel end mill reground for the fifth time. So you can make generalizations like that, but even in, you know, that's as far as it goes. And so I just don't think that sort of like a global AI overlord that tells everybody how to make parts the same and turns everything into a commodity. It doesn't match the reality of what I see in shops, right? Plate work versus, you know, not plate work, vacuum, if you're comfortable tape and glue, I don't know, big parts, small parts, working off castings. It just, everybody has a different specialty. Again, it's just like medicine. Like, there's no, every doctor is a little bit different. Everybody has a niche, and there's that, you know, that perfect patient for every doctor and that perfect part for every shop. I don't know how that goes away. I don't know how you make like a Ford assembly line version of prototype manufacturing. That just doesn't make sense to me.
I don't either. I think the rainbows side of my, I really just like the title Snowflakes and Rainbows. So I'm forcing the rainbow side. But yeah, I just really feel very committed and strong that we are in no better time to start a machine shop, grow a machine shop, you know, all that stuff. So I'm sure I had some eloquent thing to share there. All right, a couple more. So outside of Toolpath, what projects or hobbies kind of consume your time? I don't see a ton of stuff consuming your time because we both text very late and all that kind of stuff. I know what you're doing most of the time, but you do have some fun stuff. Do you feel like sharing?
I might be digging a big hole in my backyard.
Did you murder somebody?
My son came home one day and he was playing at his friend's house and they were digging a hole in the backyard and his friend's parents were like, "Stop ruining our yard. Don't dig a hole." And I kind of half jokingly said, "You could dig a hole in our yard. I don't care because I literally don't care." Yeah. And he was like, "Really?" And so I took it a step further and I was like, "Yeah. In fact, because our backyard kind of goes up on a hill, like from like away from the house." I was like, "Yeah. In fact, if you dig a hole big enough for a shipping container, I'll put a shipping container in it."
Awesome.
And he was like, "Really?" And I was like, flat out, "Yes. If you, here's a shovel. If you dig a hole big enough for a full size shipping container, I will pay whatever it costs to have a shipping container put in that hole." And he was like, "Cool." And he ran outside and started digging. Right. Yeah. And so now he has like a 4 foot by 4 foot by 4 foot hole, which is a pretty big hole for a 13-year-old kid.
Small.
Yeah. But he's also like done digging the hole for now. So I may need to like start digging a little bit to reinvigorate him. But I want him to like dig a hole big enough for a shipping container, maybe a half size. He's negotiating. He was like, "Can we do a 20-foot one instead of a 40-foot?" And I said, "Sure, you can do a 20-foot one."
Justin, this is the longest I've sat up straight since I broke my neck quite a few months ago. I wanted to look professional for you. I even put on a collar over my neck brace. I really enjoyed this. I'm proud to be a big part of, or small part, whatever part, of what you and Andy started. It's been a really fun journey. It's had its ups and downs, but I think we're at a really exciting time. By this time, we will, I'm sure, have announced that Cam's coming out of beta. It's not a really meaningful change from anybody's experience, but what it meant to me to be a person that signed off on it was, I made a pretty good selection of parts that I was proud to take from, you know, from my computer to my personal machine, and proudly say that it was a huge accelerator for me. So, I'm freaking stoked to be here. I wish I was in better circumstances with my neck in the last several months, but, it's been a freaking fun journey, and I'm really proud that you're in a place that you can take some time away, do some rad stuff away from Toolpath, and I trust that the team will treat it well while you're gone.
I know
any
you guys,
parting words?
I know you guys have it. Yeah, I'll just say that you know, I appreciate the kind words, but I don't feel like it's my accomplishment as much as I feel like I'm lucky to be a part of everybody's accomplishment. I'm sure we wouldn't be where we are if you and Al and Paul Kloss hadn't joined the team.
Yeah.
You know, Ben's hard work, everybody, all the developers, like my contributions at this point feel far in the past to me. I'm also excited to feel comfortable taking some time off. I need it.
Yeah.
And I'm looking forward to coming back and hopefully getting to solve some next hard problems and keep us moving forward.
Good, good. I'm going to end with, I have been lucky enough to spend a significant amount of time around world-class people, from athletes to, I think we did something really special at Autodesk with HSM and Fusion. A lot of that was because of the special people around it and the passion that we put into it. I feel like we really did build a dream team here, and this is me pimping, what I think is going to be a pretty rad series. We'll do more of these, get to know other Toolpathers. I have a few that have already raised their hand. So pay attention, keep an eye out for that. We have a pretty cool team, with a bunch of special people. So thanks for being the first on that. And I'll hit stop and let everybody back to their day. This is also probably the longest one I've done. So thanks, Justin.
Cheers.